You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints, our latest collaboration with Randy Credico, and live on the fly, Julian Assange countdown to freedom will be joined for an update on the current fate of Assange by legendary filmmaker John Pilger, whose latest film is The Coming War on China. Does it look like there's a war on China? Keep an eye on that work, and of course, always keep an eye on the work of John Pilger. Again, Dennis Bernstein, Flashpoints, Randy Credico, live on the fly. John Pilger, straight ahead in one moment. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here in the studio here in Northern California in the studios of KPFA down the block from the University of California at Berkeley Broadcasting, and proud to have Randy sitting next to me. And of course, we are both delighted and proud and anxious to have on our show again the great and legendary filmmaker John Pilger joining us from Australia. Latest film, as I said, The Coming War on China, but oh, the amount of filmmaking, incredible filmmaking, the way in which John Pilger changed history is unequaled in the last century, and I mean in the last hundred and whatever years. John Pilger, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. Randy Credico in the studio. Hello.
Very, very good to be talking to you and Randy, Dennis.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Please say hello, Randy, so people can know it. It's
hi,
a fact you're in the studio.
It's great to be here, Dennis. I was in New York this morning, and I got here today, and this is a very special day to have John Pilger on. You know, we started the series, Assange Countdown to Freedom, back April 2nd, 2017, and John and Julian Assange were the first two guests. So we kicked it off there. John did numerous shows over that next 4 or 5 months, and we continued with you right here at KPFA. So it's great to actually be in
indeed
the studio.
And to let people know, that series is going to be available to you. We're going to tell you about that later, but we have to get deep into the content again. John, thanks for joining us. Let's start off with the latest. What do we know about how Julian Assange is being treated and the state of his being?
Well, the state of his being is pretty much the same as I understand it. He's not well. He needs medical attention, the kind of diagnostic treatment that you get only in a hospital. But it's been made clear to him that if he attempts to go to hospital, he won't be allowed free passage, and he'll be arrested. So his health isn't good. What do we know about the machinations of a number of governments around the case of a man who, since he was arrested in 2010, has not been charged with a single crime, whose treatment amounts to the most unprecedented persecution. Now, Julian Assange could leave the embassy if his own government, that is the government of his homeland, Australia, applied legitimate diplomatic pressure on behalf of its citizen. There's no question about that in my mind, and we must ask ourselves, why hasn't this happened? My own feeling is that there is a great deal of collusion between the Australian, the British, and the US governments And the collusion is, in the end, to either close down WikiLeaks completely and or to deliver Julian Assange to the Americans. Recently, the Australian Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, and senior officials traveled to London and to Washington, and I'm reliably informed they raised the whole matter of Julian. But they raised it in a way that didn't support the whole idea that a government should represent its citizen. It listened, these people listened to the more powerful governments and listened to their intentions of what they had in mind, listened to their evasions. In Washington, where they met Mr. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, as I understand it, he refused to discuss Assange altogether, and this was not challenged. I think there is a collusion that amounts to really attempt to try and do a deal with Julian Assange that he might be allowed out of the embassy, he might be allowed free passage of return to Australia if he shuts down WikiLeaks. I'm not absolutely certain of that, but I think that is very, very likely. And as I understand Julian, that's something he wouldn't even contemplate considering. But that might be one of the so-called wretched deals that are being offered Julian Assange. There's some very strange things being said by senior members of these governments. One of them, the new Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, Jeremy Hunt, said, it seemed sarcastically, that the British police would offer Julian a warm welcome, as he put it, when he came out, where he would face serious charges. There are no serious charges. There is a bail infringement, which is far from being a serious. That he hasn't been charged with anything. There are no serious charges. Was Hunt referring to a deal that has already been done with the United States on extradition? I don't know. But this is the kind of milieu of pressure and machination around somebody who has the right, basic right of natural justice of his freedom. Putting aside freedom of speech, the persecution, the treatment of this man has been something that should horrify all free-thinking peoples. If it doesn't horrify us, then we've surrendered something very, very valuable.
And among those of us who perhaps should be more horrified are our brothers and sisters in the journalistic community. Now, I want to bring Randy in a moment, John, but I also wanted to get into the health and his treatment, but I also want to once again put on the record why Julian Assange is such a significant journalist, why so many international institutions, major journalistic institutions, collaborated, if you will, with him based on the information that he could provide. You name the major news source, the corporate news source, and they ate it up. They've forgotten now, but I think it's important to say we're talking about a publisher, a significant reporter who changed the history of our time. Correct? Is that an overstatement?
No, I don't think it is an overstatement. Nothing in my lifetime as a journalist has equaled the rise of WikiLeaks and the extraordinary impact on journalism. I mean, WikiLeaks is probably the only journalistic organization that has 100% record of accuracy and authenticity. Most of us at some point get something wrong. All of WikiLeaks' revelations have been authentic. Not a single bogus release has happened under WikiLeaks, right across the spectrum. And it's been done without fear or favor. Although there's been a concentration on, say, the release of the Hillary Clinton Podesta emails earlier on, the Iraq and Afghan war logs, but WikiLeaks has released information that people have a right to know right across the world. It's released something like 800,000 documents from in Russia. I mean, the irony of this is WikiLeaks has been accused of being an agent of Russia. Laughable accusation, actually. In fact, WikiLeaks has released 800,000 documents, many of which, well, I would suggest most of which, have been revelations of the government in Moscow. Some of them have been used in court cases. WikiLeaks' release of documents, its journalism, has covered a whole universal space. And that's the first time this has happened. So it's given people in many countries, from Tunisia, where the release of WikiLeaks documents foretold the unfortunately the ill-fated Arab Spring, but perhaps not so in Tunisia. That's where it began, and the people at the forefront of the uprising in Tunisia credit the release of WikiLeaks telling it what its repressive government was doing behind their back. From there to Venezuela, where it released cables by the U.S. ambassador describing in great detail how the United States intended to subvert the government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, of course, which it tried to do and has tried to do ever since. Information, this is the main point, information that is journalism and that ought to have appeared in newspapers and ought to have been broadcast. Some of it was when there was a collaboration with WikiLeaks. I mean, the Clinton Podesta cables that have seemed to have, emails, which appear to have made a number of people resentful in the United States, were published in the New York Times with WikiLeaks. And the point about the Podesta emails, that they showed the close role that the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton played in the setting up and the sustenance of extreme jihadism in that part, in the Middle East. That's a very, very important piece of information for people to know and understand. That is almost quintessential journalism. It is telling people something that they would not otherwise know. And for doing that, WikiLeaks has performed an extraordinary public service. And for doing that, of course, it has made some very serious enemies. And Julian Assange is the target of those people right now, of course.
I'm Randy Credico here in KPFA Studios in Berkeley. This is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein and a special collaboration, ongoing collaboration, Flashpoints and Live on the Fly, Julian Assange's Countdown to Freedom. And we are talking to award-winning journalist and filmmaker John Pilger, who joins us from Australia. John, you talked about some of the accomplishments by Julian Assange as a journalist and WikiLeaks. People forget that he's a human being as well, and he's got – I've met him three times inside that embassy. You've known him for a long period of time. Tell us the kind of person Julian Assange is so people get a feel of the kind of character, what a great man he really is.
Well, I think Julian is a very principled individual. He feels very – strongly about the moral principles behind the whole idea of WikiLeaks. When he set up WikiLeaks, he actually wrote it down that he, and I paraphrase this, that WikiLeaks, that the whole idea of transparency, of letting people know, giving, honoring people's right to know, was the aim of WikiLeaks, and he feels that very strongly. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, any attempt to do a deal with Julian to shut down WikiLeaks will, I've no doubt, be resisted, because he sees WikiLeaks as honoring almost a contract between open and free journalism, the release of information that governments and great vested interests would prefer we did not have. He sees that as pure journalism. As a person, he's a very extremely interesting man. He's very well read. He studied physics. He has a sense of science. He has a very good sense of humor, and quite a black sense of humor. And I've often laughed out loud with him about some situations that others might regard as just too bleak to discuss. But he takes, it's one of his, I think, part of his great survival kit, that he has this black sense of humor. He's obviously resilient, as few people might be. I couldn't endure personally what he has, especially in recent years, but he does endure it, but not without cost, and that's where his health is has beginning to deteriorate, and those close to him are extremely worried about him. In a letter to the Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, Julian's father, John Shipton, wrote a very moving letter, and which it ends where he says, "I ask the Prime Minister to do all within his favour to return Julian home before Julian's situation becomes irreversible tragedy." And that's coming from his father. And that's why this is such an urgent case of really of justice towards a single human being, as well as of justice towards its right to function as a journalistic organisation and our right to have the information that it provides. But Julian himself is certainly paying a personal price for that at the moment. And I find it outrageous that the government of his own country, and especially a prime minister that only 7 years ago, Turnbull said, when an Australian citizen is threatened in this way, an Australian prime minister should respond. That was Turnbull before he became prime minister. I saw Turnbull in that year, actually, and took a number of letters to him, and we discussed it. And I was perhaps foolishly encouraged that he might then raise the case, but he wasn't in power then. He's now in power. And instead, this government is playing its usual role of really running the 51st state of the United States and not defending its own citizen. It's a true disgrace.
We are talking with John Pilger, Dennis Bernstein, Randy Credico here. John, what about Britain, Theresa May and her cabinet? What is their motivation? Are they getting the pressure, do you think, from the U.S., or do they have their own internal reasons why they want to keep Julian Assange quiet?
Well, I think the relationship with the United States, everything comes down to that. Australia has an almost totally servile relationship with the United States, in which its national security structure, its military, much of its academic life, and certainly much of its media is integrated into the U.S. That's not entirely the case in Britain. Britain has, since it's lost its empire after the Second World War, has been eager to play a secondary role to the new imperial power. And also Britain does have a great deal of imperial power, since it's the biggest in many parts of the world. It's the biggest corporate investor. So this is still a very powerful country, but it does move in lockstep with the U.S. on much of its foreign policy. Not all of it, certainly, but much of it, if not most of it. And not delivering, if you like, Julian Assange to the Americans, I think is probably seen in London as something is a step too far. It's interesting to see, though, the corruption that this kind of relationship does produce. I mean, when you have the Crown Prosecution Service, as the recent Freedom of Information search revealed, when you have it colluding, obviously colluding with the whole idea of keeping Julian Assange almost in a no man's land. Emails that were released showed that it tried to prevent the Swedes from giving up the case. We now know that back in, I think it was 2013, the Swedes wanted to give up the case. They saw nothing. You know, the whole Swedish case was always bogus. The pressure was on the Swedish prosecutor to give it up. But the pressure was on her from London to keep it going. And when you read some of these emails, only some of them, because most of them...
John, did we lose him?
We lose him. All right.
All right. All right. You're listening to Flashpoints. We're speaking with John Pillager in Australia. Dennis Bernstein here with Randy Credico. We're talking about Julian Assange. It's amazing. You know, we almost predictably,
this
Randy,
time.
This is like now four freaking times when we're just about to turn this around to the heart of the matter. But we'll get John back on. Let people know, by the way, that this is the last day of the fund drive. This is our last shot here at Flashpoints. We're about, we're about 60,000 in the hole. They've asked us to raise 20 to cut that, by a third. That's a lot of money, but we can do it. If you, the listener, who cares about the real truth here and why Julian Assange is a publisher being shut down, then you'll check out 1-800-439-5732. I think we've got John Pillager back on the line. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dennis.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's see. So maybe pick it up where...
the Swedish government.
I think it was... Randy was asking why I think Britain is so intransigent over this. I think it does come down to the relationship with the United States, but also Julian is seen as defying a system of that is just not acceptable. There's a real element of vindictiveness here. As I mentioned, the Crown Prosecution Service have kept this case going when the European warrant that was put out by the Swedes would have been abandoned by all of them had they listened to the Swedes back in 2013. But they secretly kept it going. And when Julian came up to a bail hearing earlier this year, was it, or last year? Sorry, I think it was last year. In London, I mean, that was an absolute disgrace where the judge talked about his access to fresh air, described his circumstances as if he was on some pleasant extended vacation. And what didn't emerge was the whole conflict of interest in this hearing, that the judge's husband was a figure deep within the defense and national security establishment in Britain, who had been named in WikiLeaks documents. Because there's no serious press, no serious media examining the whole WikiLeaks, the witch hunt, the pursuit of WikiLeaks. There's no serious media examining it. Virtually none of this emerges.
And so John, let me just... I'm dying to jump in right here because this point you're making about the responsibility of the journalists, I mean, that's coming up big for us. We're in the middle of a fund drive, and what we're always trying to tell people is what we do that's different and how we come at the news. But I want to ask you in these very direct terms, the corporate press has a deep responsibility, right? For if Julian Assange goes down, one major player in making sure that he ends up in a cell forever is the corporate press, right? They have major responsibility, not only here, in many places, for fanning the flames, for becoming part of the U.S. State Department, and for creating this all war, all the time, forever policy. This is what's going on, right?
Well, governments, as you know, Dennis, do respond to pressure from powerful media interests. There's plenty of historical cases. That happens very rarely. But when it happens, governments do change their tune. There's been no pressure from media in the United States, in Britain, in Australia, or pretty well anywhere, except, and it's an honorable exception, except in programs like yours and others that have, that might not be regarded in the mainstream, and that's almost a satirical term now, mainstream. So you're absolutely right. The responsibility of journalists for what has happened to Julian Assange and what might happen to him and what might happen to WikiLeaks, the responsibility of journalists in the so-called mainstream is undeniable. I was looking this morning at a report by the excellent Media Lens in Britain, and they were describing how the British press, the serious British press, like The Guardian, have described and reported Julian Assange and the personal abuse, the tsunami of vindictive personal abuse that has been heaped upon Julian from well-known journalists. Journalists came claiming all kinds of liberal credentials. The Guardian has probably been the worst, and this has meant, or it used to mean, used to see itself as the most enlightened newspaper in the country. So the attacks, actually, the frontal attacks, have been coming not from governments, but have been coming from journalists. You know, I described this recently as Vichy journalism, a form of journalism that now, I think, describes so much of the so-called mainstream media, named after the Vichy government in France during the Second World War that collaborated with the German occupiers. This is a Vichy journalist's journalism. It is a collaborative journalism. It's always been there. There has always been a collaborative journalism. But there was always spaces within the so-called mainstream for unbiased discussion, for the airing of real grievances, of real injustices. Those spaces have closed completely. And the attacks on Julian Assange tell us very much what has happened to the so-called free media in the West. It is not the free media anymore, and I'm not speaking in agitprop terms here. I've been a journalist for a very long time, and I've always worked within the mainstream. But the journalism I see now is part of a rapacious establishment, and one of its prime targets is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks has produced the kind of journalism that they ought to be doing. It has, in fact, shamed journalists. And perhaps there is an element of that in that might help to explain the personal abuse and deeply personal abuse of Julian Assange. In the journalists know that WikiLeaks has shamed them. It has revealed that which they have not and which they should have revealed long time ago.
It's an extraordinary moment, and it is, we're out of time, John Pilger, but it is important to note that even the attorney for the New York Times happened to mention, they didn't, you know, bullhorn this around, happened to mention, though, that if Julian Assange gets prosecuted, the New York Times could get prosecuted under the same laws.
It can get prosecuted, but I don't believe it will be.
Right.
Because power respects power. And the New York Times is part of the establishment. It may have various wings. There may be the Trump wing and the Clinton wing, but it's basically the same thing. And the New York Times is part of that. The difference with WikiLeaks is that it's outside of that. It's truly independent.
And your strongest plea to support Julian Assange, how would you put it out to the world?
Well, it's very simple. This is about justice. You know, there was a famous statement written in the 1930s by Pastor Martin Niemöller, and I can't remember it exactly, but it said basically first they came for socialists, but I didn't speak up because that didn't concern me. Then they came for trade unionists, but I didn't speak up because it didn't concern me, and so on. And, of course, finally, they came for him. Now, that may not be a precise parallel, but if Julian Assange is allowed to literally go under, then it represents the conquest of all of us. It means that we've kept quiet. We've kept quiet, and keeping quiet, of course, has allowed the great atrocities of history to take place. And this, in a sense, if he is allowed to be spirited away to some supermax hellhole, that will be an atrocity. And those of us who keep quiet should consider that.
Indeed. Well, you know, in the library, silence is golden. In the world of human rights, silence equals mass murder. I always think about the First Amendment in the United States, you know, when they say you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. But, of course, if you know the theater is on fire, you have that knowledge, and you do not speak up and you do not shout out, then those what happens after is your responsibility. And so this is how we operate. And, John, we thank you for a lifetime of extraordinary filmmaking and reporting, you know, from the ground up, reporting based on starting with the folks who are doing the suffering first, who are the object of the brutality. That's been such an example. Randy and I, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, John. Always great to talk.
Well, thank you. Thank you, both of you, and for the work you're doing. It's so important.
All right.
The best to you both.
All right,
John.
And the best
Pilger,
to you.
JohnPilger.org. .com. JohnPilger.com.
And Randy, I wanted to make that point that the press does have an extraordinary responsibility.
Yes.
And when they're silent.
That was a very good. Was that your line? That was a great line about the library being silent. And then outside, when it's silence, is mass murder.
But this is again.
That's a great line.
Is it the children? Are we silent about the stealing of thousands of children? Do we forget in 3 days because there were, you know, because everybody found out that Trump slept with another prostitute? Do we forget about the children? Not on this show. Not on this show, as Miguel Gavilán Molina also knows. Not on this show.
Right.
Now, we are in the last day of this fund drive. And I, for up until now, have refrained from using premiums, but I want to tell you that we have a chore here. We need to, we have 20 minutes, exactly 20 minutes to raise $20,000. That's a $1,000
a minute.
And people think I'm crazy to even suggest this, but we've done, in the last couple of fund drives, we've done 12, we've done 15, and we really need it. We're a bit behind, and Flashpoints is here in this last minute or two to get you to stand up and to support the work we do here, as witnessed now today by our continuing coverage with our collaboration with Randy Credico, live on the fly, in terms of Countdown to Freedom, fighting for the truth, for the freedom of Julian Assange. And Randy, I mean, I'm going to have to keep this on a pitch, but I just want to remind people that it was you also who was at the correspondence dinner at the White House, right, trying to stand on a chair
out
and say, "What about Julian Assange?" And hundreds of journalists watch you get thrown out, and I don't
dragged out,
and I don't remember
in
seeing
a tuxedo
the story
in
anywhere.
A tuxedo. No, nobody.
That was that
you
was
and Jimmy Dore. That was
at the National, me and Jimmy Dore, that was at the National Press Club. No, but it, again, all these corporate, they used Julian Assange. They made money. And then when it looks good, when they want to sort of do the patriotic thing, they turn their backs.
They gave the big award to CNN that day.
So, okay, and I'm going to let you talk freely, Randy, but I just have to say now that we are in the final minutes of this Flashpoint show. I should have been pitching 30 minutes ago, but there was no way. We had Randy was in town. This Julian Assange's life is in the balance. This is somebody who made extraordinary information that affects all of us available to the world. We're standing up. We're locking arms, as Miguel would say, with a brother in journalism. We are brothers and sisters in journalism. We lock arm and we're lock arms and we're strong in that way. Particularly the ones that are outside the corporate media. So again, now here's the number. I haven't given it to you enough, so I'm going to say it slowly, and I'm going to ask you to use it and be patient if they put you on hold. But here's the number: 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and you can do it on the web. You can just go to kpfa.org, hit the pledge button, and there's millions of things you can choose from. Here today, we wanted to put together a package that would give you deep substance, and if you have a little extra, you could spend a little extra and get an extraordinary amount of information. We've got a good chunk of the Countdown to Freedom, Julian Assange, 10 parts of that series, a 2-CD set for a $100 contribution. We've got the Robert Perry 10-hour retrospective with the late Robert Perry, Oliver Stone, Dawn Pillager, the late Gary Webb. An extraordinary dialogue on the censorship, the undermining of Gary Webb and some of the most important stories of our time. Also undermining the late Robert Perry. You can get that for $120. Both of those, the Countdown to Freedom and the Robert Perry retrospective, both for $200. Then we have the Super Pack. This is the super combo. It includes three films: When Banana Ruled, Digital Disconnect, The Doctrine of Discovery. It includes the Summer Speech Pack, MP3 CD, and it includes the book California Field Atlas. You can get all the Assange, the Robert Perry, all those films, the Summer Speech Pack, all of it for a $700 contribution. Okay, I said it. If you've got a little extra, we're going to need a whole bunch of you who want to give us $100 or $200 or $25. But we really are going to need those of you who have a little more now to stand up, step forward, and give a little more. 1-800-439-5732. Please pull out the stops for Free Speech Radio. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. or go to kpfa.org, hit the pledge button, and take an action that nobody makes you take, that you're probably home alone, that you do because you want to do something that you care about today, that you want to take an action in support of the First Amendment and free speech, an action that will stand up for this invisible university in the airwaves that you count on to give you a real alternative. Please, in these final moments of this fund drive, please stand up now and help us make back some of the money. We're a bit behind, and they're counting on us, and they're counting on you. And I'd love to do this together as a community locking arms in support of free speech. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Countdown to Freedom, Julian Assange, 10-part series, 2 CD set, $100. The Robert Perry 10-hour retrospective, $120. Both of those for $200. The super combo pack with the films, the Digital Disconnect, three films, summer speech pack, and the book California Field Out, all that stuff, everything for $700. Come on, folks. 15 minutes to go. And we're trying. I know it's a crazy thing, guys. I know it's a crazy thing, but we're trying to raise $20,000 and catch up a bit. 1-800-439-5732. I'm looking over at Mike, and he's not falling off his chair, so I'm worried that the cards aren't coming in. In one second, we're going to let Randy give it his best shot, but Miguel at least has a few positive messages.
Yes, we do. We just got San Francisco coming through. Thank you, Mike Powers, for your pledge. Ian Williams from San Jose coming through, south of here, coming through for us. And, of course, Navarro, Deborah, Martiri for her donation and pledge, and this is the time to stand with us. We are standing against time. We're standing against the storm.
And Dennis Bernstein here with Randy Credico.
And thank you very much, Dennis. And I must say that this is the place that I was able to, when I was in exile from another radio station, I came here, and we've been able to continue this extraordinary series on Julian Assange, the most important case in journalism today, the most important legal case. And you have been a bulwark. KPFA has been a bulwark. You've inspired a lot of people. People are listening right now to the station around the world. If you can help out so we can continue doing this kind of programming here at KPFA. I'm not in New York. I'm in San Francisco, in Berkeley, the Bay Area. And here's the number once again, 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA or donate online at www.kpfa.org. Please, you have an incredible amount of premiums at your disposal here. You get this Countdown to Freedom, Julian Assange 2 CD set for $100, the Robert Perry 10-hour retrospective, that's $120, and you get this super combo over here with books and all sorts of other goodies. The whole thing combined, $700. But Assange supporters, get this CD, and it will come. Trust me, this will come. For those of you who would like to get the Assange series, and you'll hear Julian Assange, you will hear Christine Assange, Julian's mother. You will hear Thomas Drake. You will hear Ray McGovern. You will hear four or five of his lawyers. You'll hear Dennis Bernstein. You will hear Julian Assange himself because he kicked off that series. And you can make any kind of donation. If you can't afford one of these premiums, then I asked you to donate $25, $50, $100. And you just do that by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. I sound like Pat Robertson. Please call 1-800-439-5732. Or I can do it as Reagan. You know, don't call 1-800-439-5732 and help out this station. Let's let them go down the toilet. Yes, Reagan would be thinking that. Nixon would say that. Don't help out KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. 5732. That's what they would think. George Bush would say that. Don't help out the station. Don't call 1-800-439-5732. All right, no. Don't listen to them, folks. Really, this is an extraordinary place, KPFA, as is Pacifica across the country, and we need them. We can you imagine if this station goes down? Who would do this?
And to think we could fit all those presidents in this little room. 1-800-439-5... Bill Clinton. 1-800-439-5732. Bill, shut up for the moment.
Bill Clinton does not like Julian.
One, he really hates him.
Yes.
1-800-439-5732. We're hoping to get the phones ringing. Miguel, did you say a few people are calling? Are all of them busy out
people,
there? We have a couple
people
open
are
lines.
Calling, and we just got a handful here of people calling in. There's more coming, and this is the time. We're in a crisis here. There's an attack against our fundamental freedom of speech. There's an attack against the press. The maniac in the White House has called a war against free speech and journalism. So this is the time to take that stand. This is the time to say, I support free speech, I support the Constitution, and I support the liberty of the people. So this is your chance to become part of this movement. 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
1-800-439-5732. We do have a couple of open lines, and we're really going to have to jump it now. You can get this whole megillah of stuff for $700, so you can get the countdown, $100. You can get the Robert Perry 10-hour retrospective, $120. Both of those incredible series. I mean, you talk about extraordinary journalism. That's what you're going to learn about in that series with Robert Perry and the work of that in terms of the series that Randy founded and allowed us to be a part of. That's incredible material. And both of those together are available at $200 contribution. Now, if what we really need now, folks, is we need a match. We need somebody. If somebody have $1,500 or $2,000 now that they can call in and that we can match immediately. We need a big one. We need a couple of big ones, and then we need to get our folks to lock arms, to stand up. We need a rebellion at the roots, Randy. That's what we need. We need folks, and they could drive the phone answers crazy. They're out there. They're listening. 8 out of 10 of the folks who are listening now haven't made the leap yet, and I want to appeal to them now in the face of what we have to do to take on Donald Trump. I'm asking you to stand up for radical free speech, fight back, no holes barred, truth to power radio. That's what we do on Flashpoints. We are that canary in the coal mine standing up against corporate disinformation. 1-800-439-5732. Let this canary sing. Let this electronic leaflet work for you. 1-800-439-5732. We need to pick it up. We're running out of time. We've got 7 minutes to go, and we've got a mountain to climb. 1-800-439-5732 or on the web, kpfa.org. But please, jump it up now. Don't wait another second. Step forward. Make a big difference and make it now. 1-800-439-5732.
I came all the way out here, Dennis. You know, I was going to come in maybe Monday, but I knew this was that important. I knew this was the last day of the fundraising drive, and that dovetailed with the importance and the situation, the dire situation that Julian Assange is in, and this radio station is fundamentally important to help out Julian Assange at this moment. This is a great vehicle, and so I'm here. I made my contribution, folks. Please make your contribution right now. It's 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You've got either the Assange series, $100. You have the Bob Perry for $120. Or you get the two for $200. Make a pledge of a couple of thousand dollars, $3,000 or $4,000, a matching pledge, and see what we could do with that. Please, folks, make that call. 1-800-439-5732. We have a few lines open right at this minute, and it is, like I said, it's fundamentally important. It's dire. We need your help.
All right, we're coming down to the last minutes in this, our chance to do our part for KPFA and Pacifica here in the Summer Drive. This is the last day. This is our last moment. And if you're out there now and you can give us 50 or 100, please, if you've got a little extra, give a little extra. If you're out there and you can come up with 500 or 1,000, it would be significant right now. If you've got 5,000, a couple of you out there could give it up for five and help us out. That would be quite sweet to see that right now at this moment. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or just call, not for the premium, but knowing that the premium is the content of the show, the content of the radio station. It is the real premium. That's what we're pushing for. That's what we're trying to do here. And we are looking, we are hoping, we are pushing. And now we're coming down to the last minutes, the last 4 minutes. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We have a ways to go. It's not going the way I wanted this to go, but that can change too. We have a few minutes to change that, and we're asking you now in our remaining few minutes to stand up and make that difference. Oh, we need your help now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. Memorize the number. Stand up. Take an action that nobody's making you take, that you take because your mind and your heart and every cell in your body says, yeah, this kind of alternative speech, this kind of alternative fight back media is absolutely crucial in this, the second decade of the 21st century. That's where we are now. It's an amazing thing. And we're more important than ever. Free speech is more important.
Imagine no KPFA. Imagine that happening. It's up to you, folks. Let's keep the station alive. Let's keep up the great programming that they have here, that they offer here. They don't have programming like this anywhere in the country. This is the flagship of Pacifica, and I love the station. And please call that number, 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. It's critical. Please show your support of this wonderful station that was and network founded by Lou Hill. Keep Lou Hill's dream alive.
And part of that dream is regaining our democracy, regaining decency in this country, and regaining the sense of freedom and liberty for everyone. We've been covering the human rights crisis at the U.S.-Mexican border. We've been covering the climate crisis. We've been covering the situation here with the environment. We've been covering Native affairs.
Palestine.
Now we need you to stand with us.
Don't forget Palestine in these last 2 minutes.
Absolutely. I mean, so many fronts.
We've got 2 minutes, Miguel. 2 minutes for people to remember Palestine and to remember Haiti and to remember the extraordinary work we do, alternative reporting that we do. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. 1-800-439-5732. Won't you please stand up? Pull out the stops. Step forward for Free Speech Radio. Do it now. 1-800-439-5732. We've got 90 seconds to go. We've got 85 seconds to go. 1-800-439-5732. I thank all of those who stepped up and honored this sort of sacred pact. We vow to bring you a real alternative, and you part of this sacred pact is to take an action that nobody makes you take, but that your mind and your heart and every cell in your body says is the right thing to do. And of course, thank you, Summer Cheney. Thank you, Doris Katzen. Thank you, Antonio Ruiz. Thank you all. Thank you, everybody who has called. In the remaining 40 seconds, you still have time to call. I'm not giving it up until I have to. 1-800-439-5732. Randy, thanks for coming all the way. And I know you didn't sleep last night, so you did a terrific job.
Thank you very much. And thank you, KPFA, and Dennis Bernstein for
Miguel,
continuing.
Thank
and
you.
Miguel, thank you very much.
And
Miguel.
Mike at the board.
Bueno, el número en español
es 1-800
and in 10 segundos 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Tariq Ali on the future of Palestine. I hope you'll stay tuned. Tariq Ali is a left-leaning scholar and writer now living in London. He's the editor of New Left Review, and he's the author of more than a dozen books. He is a fine and articulate critic of the U.S. and British foreign policies. Tariq Ali was born in 1943 in Lahore, Pakistan. His parents had converted from Islam to atheism and communism, and Tariq has followed somewhat similar paths. In May 2016, he spoke at the Left Forum in New York. He was on a panel along with the American scholar and critic of Zionism, Norman Finkelstein. Ali and Finkelstein discussed the sad situation of the people of Palestine. They have suffered under a brutal and illegal blockade and military occupation by Israel, the occupation now nearly 50 years long. Today, we'll hear Tariq Ali's remarks exclusively, and we'll hear from Finkelstein in the near future. In his talk, Ali says remarkably little about Israel. In fact, he begins by condemning the people of the Palestinian Authority, the corrupt puppet government in Palestine established by and funded by the Israeli occupiers and by the United States. Ali moves on to the worldwide BDS campaign, the campaign to pressure Israel to end its oppression of Palestine through boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and Israeli products. Ali sees BDS as a good idea, but not sufficient to save Palestine. The Palestinian people need to form an organized mass movement too, as the South Africans did. And the Palestinian people will have to do it independently of Palestine's corrupt so-called leaders. Ali also touches on why the two-state solution is no longer a viable option for Palestine, and on how occupied Palestine is different from the old apartheid South Africa, and on why the Bernie Sanders movement is so encouraging. It's a wide-ranging intellectual tour de force and well worth a listen. Maybe several listens. On the past and future of Palestine, here is Tariq Ali.
I think if we're brutally honest, we have to say that the Palestinian organizations, especially the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which negotiated the Oslo Accords, has participated and collaborated in the defeat that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people.
They want you to hold the mic a little higher.
I think this collaboration was absolutely vital for the Israelis in order to do what they are now doing. And I think the debate and discussion that has now opened up, even within the PLO, is an indication that everyone now knows, there's no secret, not that they didn't know it before, that this is the way they were going. And for a long time it was difficult to say it. I mean, I've been saying it for 10, 15 years in different parts of the world, including at conferences organized by Palestinians themselves. And in private, a lot of them would agree, you're right, but we can't say it in public. I said, you have to say it in public. It shouldn't be left to people like me to say it. You have to say it. Because saying it will be helpful and will not allow the people to get too demoralized. If no one opens their mouths from within the leadership or lower echelons or lower ranking cadres of that organization, we are sunk. And in fact, as we know, the scale of the collaboration was huge. Of the money given to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian Authority, which was Palestinian but which had no authority at all, because never was there a Palestinian Authority. From the beginning, the real authority was the IDF, and behind it, the Israeli government, and behind it, the White House and the State Department, i.e. the United States of America. So there was never any Palestinian Authority. What they had was a budget. Billions came in. A majority segment of this budget was spent on what? Security. Security, let's see what is meant by security. Defending the Palestinian people against the onslaughts of the IDF? No, perish the thought. The security they talked about was to keep their own people under control and to deal with rival factions of Palestinians in Gaza, etc. That's what the bulk of the money was spent on. Where did some of the rest of the money go? It went in enriching those who were organizing this so-called Palestinian Authority. Political leaders, including right at the very top, low-level cadres, they were bought off and told, we've struggled enough, let's enjoy life for a bit. But, you know, we're all in favor of enjoying life for a bit if your own people aren't living in such dire and desperate conditions. And this is what was completely ignored. And, you know, I have a very dear friend, a Palestinian poet who lives in Cairo, who told me when I went to Ramallah, a close friend of mine, we had fought together in the old days, took me up the mountain and showed me his brand new villa, which must have cost, God knows, you know, $500,000 or the equivalent thereof. And he said, look, this is how I live now, and I'm happy. And he said, I felt like slapping his face, because not so far away were people who were living in really appalling conditions. And this money, which could have been used to aid every Palestinian family, to build schools, to build small clinics, etc., etc., was frittered away. And the Israelis knew what they were doing. They were buying off the top layers of Palestinian society within the PLO. And we have now reached a situation where I was at a conference in Spain, in Cordoba, a few weeks ago, sharing a platform with the Palestinian Minister for Finance and Economics. And everything I've said to you, I said to his face. And he admitted, he said, yeah, perhaps we spent too much on security. And I said, what about the $2 billion bribe scandal? And he said, that's exaggerated. No open denial. It's a huge tragedy that the leaders of a movement could be bought off and bought off so easily. So he then turned to me and said, well, what would you do? I said, for one thing, what I would do now really, because enough is enough, is say to the world at large, there is no authority, there is no Palestinian authority. We are going to dump it. It doesn't exist. We are just Palestinians in this region which is occupied by Israel, and dear world and dear people in the world, that's what we are. Are you going to help us? Please do. If not, we'll struggle on and live together and share each other's goods and money as long as we can, because that is what is needed. And he said, well, there's a logic in what you say. But I said, the logic, if it exists for you, has come too bloody late for the Palestinian people. They know what you've done. The Israelis do horrific things, as Norman has eloquently described and has been describing for years. But I said, being defeated by your own leadership is psychologically and politically very damning. That is much more difficult to get over, because you then say, what alternative do we have? Where are we going? So I say that as long as this is recognized, and they are beginning to recognize it, it's difficult not to, that they have lost the battle for a Palestinian state. That Palestinian state which they dreamed of, even on the 67 frontiers, is not going to happen, because the occupation settlements have just encroached too far into Palestinian territory. There is no Israeli government which is going to remove them, because it won't have the support of its own population to do so. The United States is indifferent, always has been indifferent to the fate of the Palestinians, and more so after the 67 war. So there's going to be no help from the so-called international community, by which is just a code word for referring to the United States. There's no such thing as an international community. So in this situation, far better that the Palestinians acknowledge of their situation and then see how to proceed forward. The situation is grim. It's pointless prettifying it or finding hope in tiny things. Not that these tiny things are not important. The BDS campaign is important. It's important not because it'll bring down the Israeli government. That is an illusion, that it will bring down the Israeli government. The South African government was not brought down by sanctions. It was brought down by the defeat inflicted by the Cuban army on South Africa. But sanctions on their own are never decisive. I nonetheless support them. Why? Because it is an important way to project what is going on in the world of Israel and Palestine and in the world at large, and on that front it's been effective. The reason the Israeli government is so hostile to it is not that they feel threatened by the sanctions, but because it disgraces them. It shames them. They have to answer questions about it. When campuses in the United States or parts of Europe stand up and say, we demand a boycott of Israel, it shames even the American government, which finds this horrifying, and European governments, which have done absolutely nothing to aid the Palestinians. So these movements, societal movements from below, are extremely important from that particular vantage point, and that's why I was a signatory to it, from the beginning, without any illusions, but understanding its importance. And this is why now there's a huge campaign. They've outlawed BDS in France, which, by the way, is the most pro-Israeli country in Europe today. And the appointment of Mark Negev, a friend of Netanyahu's and formerly Netanyahu's press officer, who you probably saw complacent and unctuous on television screens defending the indefensible, is now the ambassador in London to see if he can persuade the Conservative government to do what the French have done and make BDS activities illegal. And allied to this comes a new campaign, which is not new, of course, in the United States, but is new in large parts of Europe, whereby the chief rabbi in Britain said there is no such thing as anti-Zionism that is not also anti-Semitism. Actually said this. And said that anti-Zionism, people who talk about anti-Zionism, are anti-Semitic. Of course, liberal Jews and the Jewish Voices for Peace, thankfully, there are many more of these still in British society than the other, came out very strongly denouncing this. So there is a debate going on, and you ask yourself, why is it that suddenly this campaign of anti-Semitism got sparked off in Britain? That's because the Labour Party, to its own horror and shock, has elected a leader who is very well known for being a defender of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian movement. And it is this that has panicked them, so they're denouncing people in his circles, etc. Sometimes Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, says something which is three-quarters accurate but not 100% and says it in a temper without rationally arguing it, so they pounce on him. Or another member of parliament who 2 years ago forwarded one of Norm's texts and satirical blogs, satire is fatal these days, satirical blogs saying that all the Israeli Jews could, of course, come back and live in the United States if they want to, since many of them went from Brooklyn and so whatever. So this is so obviously a satirical blog, and she found it amusing and forwarded it. She's been accused of anti-Semitism because she was foolish. Instead of saying this is a blog by Norman Finkelstein, I forwarded, then they could deal with Norman directly. But instead, she panicked and apologized and went on her knees. They've still suspended her from the Labour Party. Because the worst thing to do in these situations is not to fight back. If you don't fight back, they carry on and on and on. So this is what's going on. And you know, the irony of the situation is that if you want to know the community in Europe which is really suffering, it is the Muslim communities. Yeah. There is a huge wave of Islamophobia in many parts of Europe. I would say virtually all of Europe, which in its manifestations is not that different from the attacks that were made on Jewish people in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s and even in the 50s after the Second World War. A lot of the arguments being used against Muslims are very similar. Someone has actually done an analysis of what was written about the Jews and what is being written about the Muslims. Almost exactly the same. And yet, does anyone care? No, well, we do. But by and large, this is completely ignored because the media is a part of it. So that is the situation that we confront. And of course, you know, we fight it back. But the Palestinians have to understand, and I think increasingly they do, that the state they visualized is impossible. So the only hope, I can't see any other way out, is a solution which many staunch Israeli anti-Zionists from the Matzpen group and others have defended for a long time. And many of them educated me in this whole idea about 40 years ago, that the only viable long-term solution is a single Israeli-Palestinian state with equal rights for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Palestinians, Druids, whatever. I won't get involved in an argument with Norm on Gandhi at this particular forum. I must say my views on Gandhi coming from that subcontinent are very different from the idealized picture which has been developed of him, not just by Norm, but by Western society as a whole. Interestingly enough, I can't resist telling you this, that in 1938, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee had a short list of people in front of it, and they couldn't decide whether to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Mahatma Gandhi, who, whatever my disagreements, certainly deserved it. They couldn't decide whether to give it to Mahatma Gandhi or Adolf Hitler. Which shows how deep Western dilemmas go. But anyway, I agree on Gaza, of course. I would just say to Norman that what he's described, of course, another political theorist of a current, he now doesn't like the Bolsheviks, also once asserted that the chain breaks at its weakest link. And quoting Lenin's words, one can also reach the same conclusion that the weakest link in the chain of oppression in Israel-Palestine today is without doubt Gaza. And one should concentrate efforts, all possible efforts, to try and break the blockade. I'm completely in favor of that, have supported all the ships that have gone and all the different campaigns that have been involved. But that would be a huge leap forward and would possibly revitalize the mass movement in the rest of the region, because it's true, I took it for granted that the Cubans inflicting a military defeat on this vaunted, you know, white South African army was a huge blow to them. And Nelson Mandela, the first country he visited after he was released, was Cuba. He said, we owe them a blood debt, because without that defeat, we might have been stuck for some time to come. But it goes without granted, there's a huge mass movement in South Africa, which varied, it was crushed, it rose again. You had new mass movements in Soweto and the townships. You then had armed struggle, strikes, guerrilla actions, which weren't so successful, by the way, even in South Africa. And then the Cuban triumph, and then we know the history. But the point I was going to make was that even with the blockade on Gaza being lifted, which would create the basis for a new, different type of mass movement of the Palestinians and their few allies in that region, we still have to have some overall plan which will not be fulfilled today or tomorrow or the day after. And that is where the question of what are your aims comes in, because if you have no plan, if the two-state solution is ended, you have to think, however unrealistic it might appear, at least pose the question of something else. And I think large parts of the world understand this now. Instinctively, it's true that in Europe, public opinion now, I mean, there have been a number of polls when they've actually asked, which do you think is the most dangerous state in the world? A fairly large proportion of Europeans, especially the young, reply Israel. Why? Because they know Israel is a nuclear state. They know it's carrying out quite a brutal occupation. They know that the United States backs it. They fear because that there could be an accidental nuclear war. Who knows what as a war of last resort? So there is this growing feeling, which, of course, the elitist politicians in Europe don't represent and don't reflect. But some big shift and some big movement within the region itself could spark off real mass struggles or movements to put huge pressure on the governments of Europe and, I hope, North America. I mean, the thing about Bernie Sanders' campaign, which I should say, is that in all my memory of American politics, my own memories and experience, I have not seen a campaign like this. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong. That a campaign to become the candidate of a mainstream party virtually launches a huge popular movement and a popular political movement, not a single issue movement, in this country. Now, I know at the Left Forum there are many critics of Bernie, and fine, that's normal. But it's not even a question of his person, actually, in some ways. Why couldn't anyone else have triggered such a movement off? Precisely because of he's different from the others. People feel that. It was the same with Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. And when people were asked, but how can you like him? Pollster said, but why do you like him? The reply came, because he's different from the politicians. And the politicians are quite a hated subgrouping now, globally, but especially in Europe. And the fact that I think Sanders is the first serious senior politician of a political party who did not go to AIPAC, that does mark a small breakthrough, and we should be grateful.
Yeah.
Because that breaks... it does just break... It breaks the hold this organization has over the political structure. I mean, no other country, this is an imperial power, the most powerful country in the world, and after 9/11, both the Senate and the House voted a blank check. A blank check to Israel. Whatever you do, we will support you. Whatever you do, you can wipe out the entire Palestinian nation, and we will support you. Unheard of. Unheard of. So, as time proceeds and as the decades pass by, it would be great to mark the 50th anniversary of the occupation, being able to celebrate something. And the lifting of the siege of Gaza, the sanctions on Gaza, the victimization of Gaza, would be a huge step forward. So on that, I'm in total agreement. It's not enough, of course, but it could be the pattern and the launch pad for something much, much bigger in the region. Because what is clear is that there's going to be no help from any other Arab state. Not that, there was too much even before this, but at least during the days of Nasser and Arab nationalism, they tried, they gave them refuge, they trained them, they gave them weapons, they helped. That's all gone now, with the Saudi Arabians effectively on the same line as the Israeli government. Think about that. The most hardened faction within Islam, the Wahhabis, literalists, Islamic literalists, effectively on exactly the same line as Israel because of factional disputes against their rivals within Islam and because they are now fearful that something might happen inside their own country. So it's a very strange situation which releases the Palestinian movement in many ways from the Saudis and from these other countries, which helps a mass movement if it's politically and psychologically independent of some extremely unpleasant regimes in that region.
Tariq Ali, speaking on the future of Palestine here on New World Notes. Thanks to David Schoenfeld, my colleague at WWUH in West Hartford, for making available the complete audio recording, which I have edited and condensed for radio broadcast. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, inviting you to check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up Call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the speech given by Barbara Honegger from the online conference called Deep Truth, Visionaries Speak Out. She's part of one of the panels that was banned by the Left Forum. Apparently, this information is too dangerous for you to hear. Barbara Honegger used to work for the government during the Reagan administration. She's an amazing researcher and wrote the book October Surprise about the Iran-Contra affair. And she's produced a video about the Pentagon on 9/11 called Behind the Smoke Curtain, which can be found on YouTube, and I highly recommend it. She has spoken widely on 9/11, including here at the University of Hartford. The speech you're about to hear has been lightly edited due to time constraints. So here she is, Barbara Honegger, speaking on the panel called False Flag, Mass PSYOP Events as Pretext for Wars and a Surveillance State. And her speech is called 9/11, Gladio Brought Home to the U.S. So here she is, Barbara Honegger.
Thank you, and it's an honor to be here. So the topic that I've decided to talk to you about is 9/11, and I'm going to support this as an American Gladio attack, and I mean that quite literally. I'm dedicating this presentation and everything else that I do from now on to Judge Ferdinando Imposimato. He was the former Chief Justice of Italy's Supreme Court. He personally prosecuted the Gladio false flag terror attacks in his country of Italy, and he and his investigative magistrates there, they have a slightly different legal system than we do, actually a very different legal system based upon Napoleonic law. He and his investigative magistrates, when he was there on the Italy Supreme Court, actually uncovered the proof that the explosives that were used to massacre over 80 innocent civilians in the Bologna train station massacre, terrorist attack, actually came from the NATO base there in Italy. So he has actually written two books, at least two, if not three, on 9/11. They are in Italian. And Jane Clark and myself are working right now to do everything we can to get them translated into English and published for the world to see. This will show you something about what an incredibly courageous and amazing individual Judge Imposimato was. Unfortunately, he died about a year ago. This is a cover of a magazine in which, if I can roughly translate it, it means the judge of courage, the great courageous judge. This is a photograph of Judge Imposimato and myself at the Justice in Focus Symposium that started our quest for true 9/11 legal accountability based upon the forensic facts that the 9/11 Truth Movement has already pulled together. So this was a couple of years ago in New York City at Cooper Hall. Unfortunately, Judge Imposimato died. This is his state funeral, his state funeral procession in Rome over this past year. He was a greatly, greatly beloved man. He fought the mafia. He won cases for the mafia. His brother was assassinated by the mafia, but that didn't stop him, and he kept going forward. So what is Gladio? Now, I should say that, as I understand it, they're in Italian, but I've met with Judge Imposimato in Rome with members of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry a couple of years ago with Daniel Sheehan and Jane Clark and myself. And we learned there that his two books, at least on 9/11, which are in Italian, are making the case that the 9/11 attacks was actually an American Gladio. And in my presentation, which I gave in Rome when I met Judge Imposimato the first time, was actually on that topic. And I took it beyond what you're going to see in this presentation. What is Gladio? Gladio, in a nutshell, the Cold War false flag terrorist attacks during the Cold War against innocent civilians in Europe by the extreme right of Europe, and that included the Pentagon, the CIA, and NATO, to blame and discredit the left And what people are going to learn in this amazing presentation on 9/11, this is my hypothesis, but it's a very supported hypothesis, as you'll see, is that 9/11 was literally an American gladio with many of the same people, if not the same people, who massacred innocent civilians throughout Europe during the Cold War, actually brought their gladio attacks back to the United States. And the mother of all of those is 9/11. So what you're going to learn here, and this is my own research, I've put these dots together and gave this presentation first to Judge Imposimoto and others in Rome 2 to 3 years ago, is that the man who is the spider in the center of the web for what we're going to learn here was General Lyman Lemnitzer. So just a couple of more data points. There was the Bologna bombing I mentioned that Judge Imposimoto personally investigated in Rome, and learned, got the proof that the Bologna bombings that killed over 80 innocent civilians to blame on the communists and the socialists and anybody they didn't want to win an upcoming election in Italy to discredit them. The Bologna bombing, Judge Imposimoto and his investigative magistrates got the proof. They have the documents, actually, that the explosives that killed all those innocent civilians were from the big NATO base in Italy. There were also the Red Brigade's attacks in Germany. We now know from some books that you're going to see the covers of here in a moment that the Gladio operators, NATO, CIA, Pentagon, also, I'm sure, MI6 from Britain intelligence, they infiltrated the Red Brigades. They had their infiltrators and their informants in there who were actually responsible for doing the agent provocateur actions to provide the explosives for the so-called left to blow up innocent civilians. Then there was the assassination of President Aldo Moro, which Judge Imposimoto personally investigated on the Supreme Court of Italy. The assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, which is like the assassination of John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy here in our country. And that's another example of a gladio operation. So now I'm going to the next slide. This is just the cover of a book, The Pentagon's Nazi Mafia Gladio, NATO's Dagger in the Heart of Europe by Cottrell. It's just one of many books since the Cold War is over that proves what we're telling you about the gladio false flag operations by the CIA, Pentagon, and NATO throughout the Cold War. This is probably the most important book by Professor Daniel Genzer, who is in Switzerland. It's NATO's Secret Armies, and everyone in the world really needs to read this book. This is no longer speculative. These are facts. The next slide. This is just an example of how anyone, in this particular example, Professor Daniel Genzer, he not only looked at, for his in-depth study, proving the gladio attacks by the Western radical right-wing powers against the so-called left in Europe to discredit them throughout the Cold War, but he is also a major truth teller on 9/11. And this is a screen from the beginning of his presentation for the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The next slide, this is just one example, but we know for a fact, and I personally know for a fact, and know this individual personally, his name is Colonel Oswald Lewinter, and I believe that's U.S. Army Colonel. He also claimed that he had a position in the German army and German intelligence, and he made a lot of claims. But anyway, he's now deceased, I believe. But this man, you're looking at a screen capture from the segment in the BBC special documentary on Operation Gladio, called Operation Gladio, that you can see online on YouTube. And this man comes on at the screen at this time, and you can hear him talk about how he was the CIA's liaison to Gladio. And believe me, there was, and I'm certain still is, probably under a different name, a so-called Gladio liaison office in the Pentagon and also in the CIA to this day. This is a man who, by the way, was didn't know it at the time until later because this documentary came out after my book October Surprise was published on the deep story behind Iran Gate. But this man was one of the three then anonymous witnesses or sources for my book October Surprise. If you read my book October Surprise, he is Informant Y. This is the cover of my book, October Surprise. And for anyone who would like to get it, it's still available on Amazon. I think you can buy it for 35 cents now. It was published in 1992 or 93. So please get this book. And there is a section all throughout the book is about Informant Y. And the link to the October Surprise in Iran-Contra, believe it or not, and my source for that was the man you just saw, Colonel Oswald Lewinter, CIA's liaison to the Gladio false flag terrorist attacks in Europe throughout the Cold War. The link is that he was my source, and there's a whole chapter in this book, October Surprise, by me, on his information that I supported with other sources that the then secret Gladio stay behind stores throughout Europe were actually drawn down and raided to send to Iran during the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign as the so-called bona fide arms shipments that cemented the treasonous October surprise deal between the Reagan-Bush senior presidential campaign in 1980 and the Khomeini regime to delay the release of our 52 hostages, ensuring Carter's defeat in exchange for a minimum of $5 billion of arms that then flowed to the Khomeini regime against the law right after Reagan and Bush gained office. That is my book, October Surprise, and it's directly linked to the Gladio stay behind stores in Europe. So knowing this, could the NATO, Pentagon, CIA black operations teams that we know, it's been proven, mass murdered innocent European civilians throughout Europe, not just in Italy, Germany, but other countries, throughout the Cold War, possibly have perpetrated the same thing here in the United States? Could they have brought their CIA, Pentagon, NATO black operations back home? Yes, they could have. And we know they did. This next slide, which is slide 14, Operation Northwoods document, many people who are watching this presentation know about this already. This was signed by General Lyman Lemnitzer. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when this was signed in March 1962, when President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, was still alive. This document, as many people know, I'm only going to be able to give you a thumbnail sketch, but what this document does is it was actually approved by every single member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not just by General Lemnitzer, who was the chairman. That is, it was signed off on. It was originally, you can see, top secret. No longer is. It's out in the public domain. So what did it do? This document that was approved by every single top officer of all of our four military services in the United States in 1962, shortly before President Kennedy was assassinated, what did it do? It approved of terrorist attacks on innocent American civilians using an airliner with so-called carefully selected CIA passengers, swapping that plane for a remote-controlled plane that was mocked up to look like the original civilian airliner that would then be blown up with an onboard bomb to frame Castro's Cuba to justify an invasion of Cuba. And as you're going to see, this is one of the two major templates, or three major templates, for what actually happened in the United States on 9/11's template for the actual 9/11 attacks. So what about what happened on 9/11? What about clearing the skies of all civilian airliners? Slide 17, this is the cover of the book by the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Keene and Hamilton. It's called Without Precedent. When you read the book, what do they mean by without precedent? What they refer to, amongst other things, but very clearly and explicitly in the book, is that never before, they claim, it's a total and complete big lie, never before 9/11 were all of the civilian planes completely cleared from the skies over the United States of America. That is a lie. It happened in 1962, on October 12th of 1962. You're about to see this. It was the brainchild and masterminded by the same man, General Lyman Lemnitzer. It was called Sky Shield 2. It is one of the templates and precedent for 9/11 on September 11th, 2001 in the United States. He commanded and organized and oversaw Sky Shield 2. It was October 1961, not 62. It was executed on October 12, 1961, which, by the way, happens to be the birthday of the U.S. Navy. That was only 6 months before the same man, General Lyman Lemnitzer, signed that Northwoods document plan that he tried to get President Kennedy to approve to massacre innocent American civilians, to blame it on Cuba as a pretext for invading Cuba. Kennedy said no. And Lemnitzer and the Joint Chiefs of Staff were furious, and we now know that they were definitely complicit in the assassination of President Kennedy not long afterwards. So the twin templates of the 9/11 plot, as you'll see, were developed by the same individual who also, General Lyman Lemnitzer, believe it or not, after he proposed this plan, this Sky Shield 2 plan, to President Kennedy fired him, but promoted him up, and he headed NATO. And he went on to create the Gladio operations in NATO. So Sky Shield 2, what did it do? This is on October 12th of 1961. It was overseen by NORAD and the Air Force. It cleared the skies over the entire United States mainland of all non-military planes. Now, in this case, a little different than 9/11, the skies were cleared on October 12, 1961. However, the American public was alerted that it was going to be an exercise, a so-called counter-Soviet Union attack coming over the North Pole, over Canada. And so if you go back in the microfiche, which I did, I've done that. And by the way, I'm the source for alerting Barry Zwicker to this, which is in his book on the media cover-up of 9/11 and media complicity in 9/11. So the United States citizens and United States Congress were alerted in advance that it was on the front page of the New York Times. You can read this in the microfiche. So it cleared the skies over the entire United States mainland of all non-military planes on the day of the exercise, October 12, 1961. Canadian planes in that exercise played the attackers, the pretend Soviet attackers, and Pentagon planes played the blue team defenders, the Pentagon fighter jets. NORAD radar screens, you read this in the cover stories of the New York Times on this, the day before. NORAD radar screens were tagged, they tagged the exercise plane blips that were inserted on the radar screens with a little icon FK for fake, for a fake plane. And what's the source for this? Believe it or not, besides the New York Times microfiches from those very days before, during, and a few days after SkyShield 2 in October of 1961, is the Air Force's own publication on September 11th attacks. It's called Air War Over America. I highly recommend it to everyone. Now, people need to know this if you don't already. On 9/11, what are the parallels to what you've already seen? The Pentagon and NORAD, the same agency that did SkyShield 2 in 1961, shortly before President Kennedy was assassinated, the Pentagon and NORAD conducted hijack scenario exercises on the morning of 9/11. They were scheduled to begin, depending upon the agency, just before or just after the actual attacks, that were piggybacked on similar or even identical scenarios as the so-called exercises. And believe it or not, General Eberhardt testified to the 9/11 Commission. You can still see this, the 9/11 Commission, the National Archives website, the video of his testimony. The head of NORAD on 9/11, General Ralph Eberhardt, actually referred to them as a, quote, Soviet-era exercise. Well, excuse me, the Soviet Union kind of ended back in 1981, didn't it? So why is it a Soviet-era exercise? It was a Soviet-era exercise because they took the Gladio operation and SkyShield 2 off the shelf, dusted it off, and that's what was behind the planning for the 9/11 attacks here in the United States. On 9/11, radar screens also had exercise plane, FK plane injects. The U.S. skies, of course, in this case, after the actual plane impacts, were cleared of all civilian airliners. But this was, believe me, not without precedent. It had been practiced many times by NORAD and our Department of Defense and CIA and our whole black ops intelligence apparatus. The World Trade Center 2 plane was not a civilian airliner. We'll be getting into that. I added that because we know that for a fact, and we know that for a fact at the Pentagon already as well. I'll be getting into that here in a moment. But the whole point of that is in the Operation Northwoods plan signed off on by the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff, signed by General Lemonster, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that plan, of course, was for a civilian airliner to leave an airport and then be swapped for a military plane or a CIA plane that was mopped up to appear like the original civilian airliner that would then be destroyed. The Pentagon attack, bottom line, as you'll see, that is my expertise. It was a self-attack. The Pentagon attacked itself using a remote-controlled plane mopped up to appear to be an American airline airliner that was destroyed by remote control. And I believe that we're going to be able to prove, I do that in my Behind the Smoke Curtain YouTube on the Pentagon attack. I believe that we can prove that that remote-controlled plane that was swapped for the plane that left Dulles Airport, that is alleged to have then made it to the Pentagon, which didn't, was actually one of the special planes of the number three or number four man under Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, Dov Zakheim. That was his business on the side. All right, this is the cover of my DVD, Behind the Smoke Curtain, and it is on YouTube. It has over 500,000 views. Please do watch it because I'm not able to get into all of the evidence here. Next, now that we've seen that Pentagon, CIA, NATO, Black Ops mass murdered European civilians and authorized it here in the United States, the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff, what is the evidence also that this is the real story of 9/11? And what is that real story? The FBI Strategic Intelligence Operations Center, this will give you a good hint, filled to capacity on 9/11. This is a quote from then director of the FBI, Robert Mueller. This is the cover of Time magazine, May 10th, 2011. On 9/11, the FBI's operations center filled to capacity through, and this is still part of his quote in Time magazine, Pent Bomb, P-E-N-T-T-B-O-M. That's short for bomb, B-O-M-B. This is still his quote. The FBI's cryptonym for Pentagon, Twin Towers, and bombing. That's bombing. Not planes, not fires, not hijackers, but bombing. pre-placed explosives. This is a slide just showing you that the Oklahoma City Federal Building and the Pentagon after the explosions, the FBI's cryptonyms or abbreviations for their investigations of so-called terrorist attacks that are actually inside jobs like 9/11 was, and the Gladio operations in Europe were, to be blamed on somebody else in the case of 9/11, Muslims, so-called radical Muslims who didn't do it. They probably had a plot to do it, but the plot was hijacked and done by our own inside black Gladio black operators. This is an example at the top, the Oklahoma City FBI investigation, code name is Oak Bomb. We already know, and the official story of the FBI and everybody else in the government is that it was a bomb, a place bomb. Of course, the bomb in the Ryder truck is not what did this, but that's another story. And down below, Pent Bomb. The FBI and everybody who did 9/11, the inside jobbers, they know what they did. And they actually have told you that they know what they did. That's why they've called it Pent Bomb. So this is a slide number 27 where I'm visually showing you that there's the Pentagon with a Photoshop of the Twin Towers within it. And that's to graphically represent what you're now going to see at least part of. And that is the parallels between the real story of what happened at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Of course, they were the same Gladio black operators behind both, as well as Pennsylvania and the anthrax letter attacks, of course. So the real story of 9/11 at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, which are the two major places of the attacks of 9/11, are pre-placed explosives and or incendiaries in both the World Trade Center towers, World Trade Center 1 and 2, and World Trade Center 7, not hit by a plane at all, as well as the Pentagon. And when you see this evidence, you will understand that no foreign terrorists, whether it's Al-Qaeda or 19 hijackers or bin Laden, who is dying in a cave in Afghanistan, or ISIS, morphed later out of Al-Qaeda, that was actually created by Western intelligence, people like the Gladio operators. No foreign terrorists could possibly have ever had the access to plant the massive numbers of pre-placed explosives, not only in World Trade Center Towers 1, 2, and 7 in New York City, but also in the Pentagon, as you're going to see. Now I'm giving you the parallel between the Pentagon attack and the World Trade Center. The main story at both places are pre-placed explosives. This is a slide that shows you the difference in time between the first official seismic signal, massive event in the deep basements of both World Trade Centers 1 and 2 in New York City before a plane hit either tower, dozens and dozens and dozens of stories higher in the sky. Now, any kindergartner knows that if a massive explosion goes off in the deep basement, and by the way, they also went up a huge pressure wave, came up from the deep basement into the lobby, and that is the reason for the destruction and deaths in the lobby, including for Bobby McElvain, Bob McElvain's son, on 9/11. And Bob McElvain knows that about his son, by the way. We've talked about it. All right, so what's the bottom line of this slide? 14 seconds before a plane hit in the floors of the 90s, just below the top in World Trade Center 1, the very first attack of 9/11 was a massive deep basement explosion 14 seconds before that plane hit. And about 16 minutes later, at World Trade Center 2 in New York City, the other of the Twin Towers, 17 seconds before a plane hit in the 70s of the floors, way high in the sky, 17 seconds before the plane hit, a massive deep basement explosion went off in the basement of World Trade Center 2. These are facts. So let's look at the Pentagon. Could the same thing have happened at the Pentagon? Is it possible that there was a massive explosion in the Pentagon way before, in this case, not just a few seconds before, but almost 8 minutes before? The official story says the plane was even anywhere close to Washington, D.C. The official story says that a plane, allegedly Flight 77, we can prove that it's not the case. There was a plane swap at the Pentagon. The plane that left Dulles Airport, it was swapped out. And the plane that flew back east wasn't even the same one that left Dulles. Therefore, it couldn't have had hijackers on it, even if hijackers had originally gotten on the plane, and there's no public domain proof of that even. However, the official story says that whatever plane approached the Pentagon and did its deed there didn't even happen until 9:37 and 46 seconds, almost 9:38. However, it is a fact that at 9:30, almost 8 minutes before this, there was a massive explosion that went off inside the outside ring of the west wedge of the Pentagon near April Gallup's office. She's a critical witness. I call her the Willie Rodriguez of the Pentagon. And you can think of Willie Rodriguez as the April Gallup of the World Trade Center. She's an incredible, courageous witness of the Pentagon attack. Her office, if you look at this slide, which is slide 33, you will see that her office is, if you see that line that divides the two wedges, and you're looking at the west side of the Pentagon, a graphic of it, her office was to the left or to the north of that dividing line between the two wedges. But to the right, you see that white arrow space. That's the alleged official story, the alleged so-called alleged flight penetration path of Flight 77. It doesn't even get anywhere close into Wedge 2. And her office was in Wedge 2 in the outer ring, 120 to 150 feet further to the left or north than the alleged impact point of a plane almost 8 minutes later. There were a massive number of people who died. She luckily did not die on 9/11. Slide 35 is April Gallup on the lawn afterwards. Her wristwatch was stopped by this massive explosion by her desk in the Army, Secretary of the Army's area at 9:30 on 9/11. She still has that wristwatch, and it still has the explosive dust on it to be analyzed. The internal timeline of the White House itself, which I was provided by Professor David Ray Griffin, it is now in the public domain. He got it from the National Archives, now released to the public. It shows that now this is the internally compiled White House timeline of 9/11. It also comports with April Gallup's stopped wristwatch that the attack at the Pentagon was 9:30, not the official story time of almost 9:38. Over the skies of Washington, D.C. on 9/11, before the real first attack at the Pentagon by pre-placed inside explosions at 9:30, this E-4B, flying Pentagon doomsday machine, with state-of-the-art surveillance and command of control that can see everything, for hundreds of miles, let alone directly over the Pentagon, and it was very close to it, was circling over Washington before the Pentagon attack. They know exactly what happened there. They were probably controlling it from the plane. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, he became Secretary of Defense, of course, later, confirmed on ABC News, especially with Diane Sawyer, still on YouTube, that it was, in fact, the doomsday plane, the flying Pentagon, flying over D.C. and the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11, before April Gallup's wristwatch was stopped by the massive explosion inside the Pentagon, almost 8 minutes before any plane was anywhere close to Washington, D.C. I'm going to move through these next slides. They simply prove that all of the official reactions in Washington, D.C., as well as finally removing Bush from the Florida classroom, happened in response to that massive explosion inside the Pentagon at 9:30, because all of this happened right afterwards. Everything happened right afterwards. Even in New York City, where two attacks had already happened on the World Trade Center and not even yet caused the New York Stock Exchange to shut down, it was finally urgently shut down at 9:32 because of the real first attack on the Pentagon, which was by April Gallup's desk at 9:30. I'm going to move through these slides. Proof that there was pre-placed explosives at the Pentagon. This is slide number 43. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff himself, who used Shelton in his memoirs called Without Hesitation, page 434, when he got to the Pentagon shortly after the attacks, the smell of cordite, which is like a plastic explosive. It's a cool-burning plastic explosive. It was probably what was used, and we could prove that by doing an analysis of the explosive material still on April Gallup's shoe that she has saved and her wristwatch and her clothing that she has in a safe deposit box. So bottom line is there were bombs going off or explosives going off inside the Pentagon. I've interviewed people, hundreds of people saying bombs, bombs, bombs. It's a bomb. It's a bomb. Also, we have it sounded like a series of explosions going off, sounded like a series of bombs exploding. This is from somebody inside the Pentagon, two rings in inside the Pentagon on 9/11. It sounds identical to that famous clip from the Naughty Brothers video of the World Trade Center attacks, where that firefighter said it went boom, 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 like when you're bringing a building down. And that's exactly what was going on inside the Pentagon. So I'm going to move forward now. The cockpit voice recorder at the Pentagon that was made public, it wasn't even the right kind of cockpit voice recorder for any American Airlines 757 on 9/11. And we know that from American Airlines' own press release that was put out by American Airlines right after this was put out in public. It was the wrong kind. And therefore, the flight data recorder that the Pentagon and the FBI and the government rests its entire case, along with the radar records, which were also doctored, I can prove that, and do so in behind the smoke curtain, that the flight data recorder data is from a mocked-up flight data recorder that was done on, it's called a bench. It was created on a bench It's digitally created in order to make it look like what they want you to believe happened with the plane at the Pentagon. It was the wrong kind. So people, bottom line, people need to know that the real story at the Pentagon and the World Trade Center is the same by the same inside Black Ops Gladio operators. It was an inside job, and the real perpetrators are still at large, and they must be brought to justice. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to Barbara Honegger speaking at the online conference, which can be found at deeptruth.info. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with
Ken Nash, ICE training officers and military grade weapons and chemical agents.
With Ken Klippenstein, renowned American national security reporter. Hey, sounds like they're getting ready for war, a retired Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE agent said, that is Rob Oribe Olivares, to National Security reporter Ken Klippenstein on why ICE officers are being trained to use weapons that have been heretofore exclusively the province of the U.S. military.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
Why don't we start with this question, because the other Ken Nash, and myself were having this discussion. Suddenly we realized maybe we don't know what ICE was organized after 9/11 to actually do, because they seem to be traversing all kinds of issues that would be the province of Homeland Security and so on. So could you get us started on ICE after 9/11? What is its function, and then how that function is morphing into an incredibly militarized apparatus?
Well, ICE really is composed of, largely two different components. One is what's called Homeland Security Investigations, which had already existed. And then the other one is what's called Enforcement and Removal Operations. And so between those two, they're quite different. If you look at Homeland Security Investigations, they have extensive training. They often are better educated. Then you go to Enforcement and Removal officers, who are really the ones that really, they're just tasked with putting someone in a kind of paddy wagon. They're not really supposed to do investigations or long, form stuff like that. These folks tend to have much less education. There's actually some tension between the two groups within ICE. If you talk to I know several Homeland Security investigations, HSI for short, I'll say hereafter. And, they don't like being associated with Enforcement and Removal officers, ERO for short, because they feel that they're not, adequately trained. They don't have the level of education that they'd like to, be associated with. So they're actually bothered to be working under the rubric of ICE, and they would like to go, or at least, several HSI agents that I've spoken with would like to go back to the pre-9/11 setup, where they were working under, I think it was DHS, but not under ICE. And so now politicians are coming out saying things like, let's shut down ICE, let's go back to how it was before 9/11. And I've actually talked to, several ICE agents themselves who agree with that, so I don't think that's such a radical view. It certainly isn't within the agency.
And where does the Border Patrol fit in this?
Well, that's different. They have kind of a different Customs and Border Patrol. They have a bit of a different mission. Obviously, ISIS, they'll grab people and put them in detention, and then, ultimately they'll be processed somewhere else, border. But there's a lot of interaction and a lot of overlap. And again, I want to stress that when you talk to people in these agencies, they often feel like the way that these different groups are organized isn't very rational. So I think you're right to wonder, why can't we go back to pre-9/11 state? because that really scrambled everything. I think it changed a lot of different things.
Since you brought up the issue, before we get into again the increasing militarization of ICE itself, you're suggesting that there is a great deal of tension within these law enforcement or these different bodies themselves, including from very conservative forces. After all, they are largely made up of people who are hardly doing working for the Legal Aid Society's Immigration Defense Unit. So why is there this antipathy? Is there just a kind of competitiveness or a jealousy? Or
I don't think it's just a turf war, because that's what I thought at first, and you will find that, you know, say with the intelligence agencies. With this, I think that, you know, they don't like being associated with people that are breaking up families, and that's what I've been told, you know, by several of them. They use language to describe the EROs part of ICE that I wouldn't feel comfortable saying on air right now. Mm-hmm. I really think it is a, you know, genuine, sincere opposition to the policies that are being undertaken right now. And sometimes HSI gets tasked with some of that, and from what I can tell, they seem to hate it. They want to, and they feel kind of resentful that EROs, you know, get to, in the public's mind, enjoy this reputation that they're going after the MS-13, they're going after gangs. And a lot of it just isn't true. They just don't have the training to conduct the kind of investigations and to handle, you know, really sensitive matters like that. And so I think, I think they just feel as though they're sort of, I mean, as one person put it to me, said they're sort of kind of ordinary cops or maybe even glorified security guards.
So
that and that's what they're tasked with, too. They're not tasked with complex things. And so when Trump goes around and says, you know, we need to stop MS-13 and so on and so forth, a lot of that is done through FBI. It's not even done through DHS. So that a lot of that perception that they're going around shutting down gangs just isn't true for, you know, in large part.
So now we have, as you've pointed out in your very important articles, an agency that is being trained in the use of M4 assault rifles and chemical agents and stun grenades and flashbangs, according to the federal procurement records that you were able to obtain, et cetera. So how do you explain this? Is the issue of deliberately obscuring what ICE really does and talking about MS-13 and so on? Is that the rationalization for, and what's really behind, do you think, this militarization of this agency?
Well, it seems like the administration wants to arm to the teeth, and although, you know, they don't have the requisite training to handle some of these more sensitive subjects, it may be that they want them to start handling it. And I think, at least from folks I've spoken to, that would be problematic because they just don't have the background for that kind of thing. Anyways, to get into the specifics, so at the time that, you know, ICE previously, until very recently, had 5,000 M4 rifles, which I should point out, these are the standard issue rifles for the Marine Corps. That's, you know, pretty serious stuff. These are the kind of things they use overseas, say if they're in Iraq or Afghanistan or something. So they had 5,000 until very recently when they purchased 8,000 more. So they more than doubled their supply of this, you know, military assault rifle. They also signed a $15 million agreement. You know, these are all from publicly available contracts that if you go on the government contract website, you can see these things. Unfortunately, it doesn't say why, and when I asked them, they didn't really answer. When I asked ICE why they're purchasing all these things, they didn't really answer. But it does appear that, you know, that they're beefing up the organization. For what? I don't know. I could speculate that it has something to do with, you know, the administration's just dramatic, you know, increase in deportations and things like that. Perhaps they're shifting more power towards this agency away from others. But unfortunately, the records just don't say specifically what all this is for. But when I interviewed an ICE agent and I ran these things by him, you know, why do they need these chemical things, crowd suppressants, stuff like that? I didn't know if maybe they'd be handling more complicated situations or something. He said it sounds like they're going to war. He seemed really alarmed by it. And this was a former HSI agent who told me that, and you know, that really kind of sent a chill down my spine, because I figured, you know, maybe there's some explanation, because who knows what, you know, maybe they're changing their mission a little bit. But yeah, he seemed really shocked by that.
Ken, I can't help but think a couple of weeks ago we covered this vast raid with a helicopter. There was this massive raid on a meat plant in Tennessee, and And I'm just wondering, as they begin to raid these massive work sites now, if they see themselves as dealing with people, indeed, that they are at war, and as though they were, quote unquote, really handling and begun to see through the rhetoric of Trump and so on, that these are potential terrorist suspects. I mean, is there a fundamental ideological change that is driving them to arm themselves like this and also to use, which you point out, former CIA interrogators to train agents who have been trained in handling terrorist suspects? So is this pretending the kind of thing that we're going to see, which is mass raids where they might be more inclined to use these flashbangs and stun grenades and things of that sort?
Yeah, I think you're right. It seems like a general militarization of what, you know, we should keep in mind as a domestic agency. In addition to that, people might imagine that they're, you know, going after these drug gangs and narco-traffickers, but that's what we have the FBI for. That's what we have, you know, we have SWAT teams and things to handle these kind of things. So it's not like we're without the resources. And I should point out, too, that the individuals in the FBI and SWAT, those people are specifically trained. They have a lot more training in these kind of things and in crowd control situations, because there's all sorts of variables you need to think about to make sure bystanders don't get hurt, to ensure that, you know, you're not using force beyond what you need to. It's not a trivial matter to, you know, train people to track drug gangs and, you know, kind of dangerous things of that sort. And so it really seems unnecessary to, you know, task this what was previously a much more modest agency with that kind of work. And I don't, that's not what they've been doing in the past. So I feel like the only logical conclusion is, you know, they're militarizing this agency. They're beefing it up. And there has been an uptick in the tempo and the magnitude of these enforcement removal operations of undocumented immigrants. So I think that's a pretty good guess as to, you know, why they might be arming them with all this stuff. And you mentioned the CIA. So there was a former top CIA interrogator that's training enforcement removal officers in intelligence collection and what's called elicitation. It's kind of like when you're interviewing someone, gathering information. You know, when I asked an ICE agent, I said, oh, so is this usual? Because I just, you know, maybe this is something you've done for a long time. He told me, he said, oh, EROs, they don't know how to conduct interrogations or investigations, so I don't see why they would need to be trained in this. He seemed really surprised by that. And so I, you know, researched it more, and this CIA official was actually a top interrogator at the CIA. He worked in the Middle East, all over the world, but had a particular experience in the Middle East. And he was actually the chief polygrapher for the CIA for a number of years. He was also a personal bodyguard of the CIA director at one point. So this guy was not, you know, some low-level functionary at the agency by any means. And so I was just sort of surprised, you know, about why a relatively modest agency with a, you know, very clear domestic jurisdiction would need this kind of very sophisticated training. And again, they didn't give me a good reason. When I asked, they didn't really answer. So we can only speculate. But what all of these changes seem to, they all seem to be going in the same direction. There's no, it's all making them stronger and beefing them up. I haven't seen anything in the way of taking power away from them.
I'm wondering, we're talking a lot about ICE, but there's also Homeland Security more generally, and people don't talk that much about Homeland Security. So what are your wider thoughts on the other things that Homeland Security is doing outside of the sphere of ICE?
Well, under Bush, again, many of these components had already, or at least, you know, a great deal of these components had already existed, but he changed the name and then added other things to it. So, you know, DHS is going to become increasingly important as they have to deal with climate catastrophes of the sort we saw in Texas and in Florida and in Puerto Rico. And I would just let the record speak for itself. It seems pretty, it doesn't seem adequate. I mean, Puerto Rico hasn't recovered. And I think large parts of Texas are still rebuilding. So that's another big part of their mission that we're probably going to see more and more of. And that will probably become increasingly militarized as well. You know, because when you have a situation that natural disaster happens, property owners want to ensure that, you know, the law becomes more difficult to enforce because it's just so much chaos that people start bringing in either private security or governments tasked with protecting property owners' things because, you know, let's be honest, that's a big part of the government's, that's a big client of the government's, you know, property owners. So yeah, I would say that's another thing that we should keep an eye on, and we have been seeing changes to as well.
One of the other things that you had mentioned, that there was some dissension in the ranks around the very policy of the separation of families and the tender aged, who are now being kept on military bases. Now, the issue of both military bases and youth, et cetera, and the separation of families, one of the things you looked into, which I had not given thought to, was the environmental issues of that and what was happening to folks. So if you could talk about some of your research and findings there.
Sure. So there's been, you know, a fair amount of environmental testing of these military facilities by various environmental groups. The one I quote in the piece is called the Environmental Working Group. It's kind of one of the biggest ones in the United States. What they found really shocked me. They found that, you know, there were nuclear contaminants above the water table, meaning it could seep down into it. They found a number of carcinogenic materials, and none of this should come as a huge surprise because it is a military base. They do testing and things like that. And so that's bad enough that our troops are exposed to that. And, you know, there have been, I found a court case that hadn't been reported in which the biggest veterans advocacy group, you know, was litigating on behalf of a veteran who claimed that he had been exposed to huge amounts of Agent Orange when he was at the base a couple decades ago. And so even if the Agent Orange isn't stored there anymore, that kind of stuff can seep into the water and stay there for a very long period of time. And so what's new about this is when you have kids there, their brains aren't developed. And any child psychologist can tell you that an undeveloped mind is much more vulnerable and susceptible to contaminants. They can, you know, have lifelong effects that they never recover from. They can have developmental disorders, develop all sorts of cognitive deficits. It's really serious to have these young kids. And another thing I should point out, I didn't put this in the story, but, you know, I've been talking to some military folks I know, and they were telling me, oh, at bases, I never drink the tap water. God knows what's in there. We just buy bottled water from a store nearby or something. But if you have an undocumented, you know, immigrant that's detained there, obviously they can't do that. Or, you know, if by some miracle they let them purchase these things, God knows if they have any money for it. So they're probably going to be stuck drinking the tap water that you know, a lot of the troops appear to know not to drink. So I thought that was really concerning, and it was something that unfortunately hadn't got very much attention. And I just want to, you know, stress again how vulnerable these young children are going to be to contaminants. Adults can, you know, withstand these things much more, and you even have troops coming down with cases of cancer from these kind of things. So, you know, when I looked at the reporting that the Environmental Working Group had done, they found numerous carcinogens in excess of the legal limit, not just the sort of recommended limits, but it was illegal. And they found this on repeatedly over years and years and years. So this wasn't like a one-time kind of, maybe the test was off or maybe they, you know, dealt with it. As recently, I think, as 2016. So, you know, I'd like to think that they dealt with the issue, but I wouldn't guess that that's the case.
You know, one of the other issues, I just want to go back for a moment to the CIA interrogator, You revealed that it was, you know, Barry McManus, who is the former CIA interrogator, who was in the agency for 20 years. He retired, according to your writings, in 2003, and you report that he created the firm Global Traveler Security. And I just want to talk more about these things and what also is the issue of the private security forces coming into play, both in terms of the detention centers where people are held. And I, you know, I can't help but say that somewhere in the back of my mind here is always the, you know, Blackwater officers who are the private security contractors and so on. And I wonder if there is any connection with Blackwater, and if you could talk about that whole issue of the increasing privatization and, again, what seems to be this terrifying militarization of an agency whose function is not to be engaging in anti-terrorist work.
Yeah, so I said given this contract to, as you mentioned, the CIA interrogator, and specifically in the contract it describes it as, you know, counter-terror intelligence collection. And I'm thinking, what does ICE have to do with counter-terror? Am I misunderstanding its mission? And so I, you know, spoke to some former ICE people, and they told me, no, it doesn't have they don't even have jurisdiction. The Joint Terror Task Force under the FBI is supposed to specifically handle these things. ICE can't even bring charges against them because they have to handle it through FBI. They take it to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I was very confused as to why that was the case. I didn't really get a satisfying answer from McManus when I, you know, interviewed him for the story. But, yeah, I speculate that it's just the, you know, sort of mission creep that we see overseas but happening back here as well. I mean, I don't have to tell you. I'm sure that, you know, since 9/11, power appears to be concentrating more and more in, you know, these national security bodies within the country. And this just seems like another example of it. But we have a particularly zealous president in terms of, you know, prosecuting these individuals for, you know, what I should point out, so-called illegal immigration, that's just a misdemeanor. That's not a felony offense. And so people, you know, get the impression illegal, like, oh, that's pretty scary. And, you know, you can talk to any attorney and they'll tell you that, you know, it's not legal, but this is a pretty, under the legal system we have, technically it's not actually a, you know, very serious offense. So it seems sort of disproportionate to be leveling these kinds of resources against what is essentially, you know, not a particularly dangerous or harmful crime.
And I was wondering if, to take this even further, if there has been any interactions or training of ICE forces by any of the enormous, because it's a major issue of export now around the world, like the Israeli military apparatus and so on. Are they in any way involved in, or is there been any kind of cross international training?
Right. Well, I mean, McManus worked all over the world. I'm sure he's mm-hmm. worked for governments and things. So there's always a nexus of relationships that exist, because foreign militaries in particular, foreign governments, they have different sorts of expertise. And I know, you know, the Israeli military has trained, you know, domestic U.S. police, you know, in various things. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't know that for a fact. But what I can tell you is that, you know, the shift away from government, how do you say, stewardship over these kind of policies towards private, you know, for-profit companies, that's been a trend that has been happening and affects every agency I can think of. So when you look at ICE, they're farming out a lot of their work to private companies. And the concern with that is that these private companies don't have the same charter that a government agency would. And, you know, you can say all sorts of things about the government. I certainly do in my reporting, find out lots of ugly things. But the government, at least in principle, is can be influenced by the public. You know, the public can try to influence what its policies are. It technically is supposed to, you know, respond to public and democratic will. And there's a kind of transparency, too, that exists. So, for instance, I could file as a reporter, or anyone could do this, but I do all the time, I could file a Freedom of Information Act request to a government agency. However, if it's a private body, I can't do that because there's just no presumption of transparency. So when you shift things, I talked to a former Blackwater guard. It's kind of funny you bring that up. And I asked, I said, so why are they moving all this stuff towards these private companies? He said, well, think about it. If it's a private company, there's no legal requirement to report all sorts of things that exist for the Defense Department or something else. So it's a great way to sort of insulate yourself from scrutiny in a way that you couldn't if it was the Defense Department, because everything is going to get declassified in 10 years or so, or could get brought out if someone decides to litigate a FOIA request or something like that. So, I think the shift towards relying more on these private bodies has increased the secrecy and decreased the public, you know, transparency to see what these guys are up to.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Ken, where can people get some of your most up-to-date writings?
Well, these days I'm writing for, it's called TYT Investigates. If you just Google TYT Investigates and check out the list of stories there, you'll see mine pop up. Or you can follow me on Twitter. My name is Ken Klippenstein, and my handle on Twitter is @KenKlippenstein. Last name spelled K-L-I-P.
And Ken is one of the renowned American national security reporters, and we've been talking about ICE training officers and military-grade weapons, chemical agents, and militarizing the entire apparatus. Ken, thanks for joining us. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, reminding you to listen to Mimi on Wednesday mornings from 6 to 8 a.m.
Thanks for listening, and do support WBAI.
You can have all the money in your hands, all the possessions anyone can ever have.
but it's all worth this treasure. True worth is only measured not by what you got, but what you got in your heart. You can have, you can have everything, but what does it, what does it mean? It all means nothing if you don't stand up for something. You can't just talk the talk, you got to walk that walk. Yes, you do. It all who's looking back at you? Define the life you're living, not by what you take but what you're keeping. And if you bet on love, there's no way you'll ever lose. Take a stand, make a stand for what's right. It's always worth, always worth the fight. It all means nothing if you don't stand up for something. You can't just talk the talk, you got to walk that walk. Yes, you do. It all.
That's what we do. We stand up. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
YouTubers have flagged YouTube's search algorithm for being biased against transgender videos and producers. But if YouTube suppresses this content, it can deprive young people of critical knowledge.
I want to begin a future with a person I love to marry. I want to be happy with my child and my family. I also want protection and the support I don't have in my country. This is why I came, for a happy future.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A storied Singapore leader's grandson, Dots the Pink, YouTube Math sells trans content short, and U.S. border chaos engulfs a Salvadoran lesbian mother and child. Those stories and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 28, 2018. Singapore's 10th annual Pink Dot Festival, celebrating the diversity of love in the Southeast Asian city-state on July 21st, was said to have broken all attendance records and was preceded a few days earlier by the proud self-outing of the grandson of Singapore's revered founder. Thousands converged on Speaker's Corner in Hong Lim Park, the only area in Singapore where pre-approved public demonstrations are allowed. Most celebrants were adorned in pink and carried pink-hued flashlights. As night fell, thousands formed a large glowing heart that melted human hearts in photographs taken from high above the park. We couldn't find a published crowd estimate this year, but some 20,000 people bathed the night skies in pink in 2017. The government has done its best to suppress the event. It banned foreigners from sponsoring or participating in the Pink Dot Festival in 2016. Several multinational conglomerates with offices in Singapore had provided major financial support until then. But organizers persevered, recruiting a total of 113 local business sponsors this year, all in compliance with a government edict.
The theme of Pink Dot 10 was We Are Ready, accompanied by demands for equal rights for LGBTQ people in the nation's schools, workplaces, and healthcare system. Singaporean actors Adrian Pang and Lim Yu Beng called for the repeal of Section 377A of the Singapore Criminal Code, the remnant of British colonial rule that, like India's Penal Code Section 377, makes private consensual adult same-gender sex a crime. Theater director Ivan Heng, who married his husband in London in 2014, echoed this year's Pink Dot theme by saying that we are ready to see more positive portrayals of LGBTQ people in our mainstream media without censorship because we are sick and tired of being seen as tragic characters or vilified as perverts. Premier Lee Hsien Loong has said that he's prepared to keep Section 377A on the books until social attitudes change. His nephew, 31-year-old Lee Hwan Wu, who's also the grandson of Singapore's first prime minister, Lee Kuan Yew, is doing his best to speed up that process. He came out with his 27-year-old partner by his side, veterinarian Hirui Heng, a few days before the Pink Dot Festival, where the couple was widely photographed. Hwan Wu urged straight allies to attend in a Facebook posting and wrote that all LGBTQ people have a moral responsibility to come. If you do not stand up yourself, he wrote, you cannot expect others to fight for you.
Barbados Islanders celebrated LGBTQ Pride for the first time on July 22nd in the capital city of Bridgetown by dancing down the street to soundtracks blaring songs like Diana Ross's I'm Coming Out. A colorful carnival atmosphere prevailed as an estimated 150 local activists, their supporters, and even a few tourists paraded through downtown. Organizers faced less than smooth sailing to pull off the march, however. They only secured permission to hold the event 2 days before it kicked off and faced vocal opposition from fundamentalist religious leaders. Several told a press conference the week before that the queer agenda is a form of neocolonialism that opposes the biblical narrative of Adam and Eve. One of the organizers, Rowan Mohammed, told Pink News that she genuinely feared that the venomous rhetoric would spark homophobic violence at the parade, but was pleasantly surprised by the amount of love and positivity that overwhelmed the air. Mohammed said she was especially encouraged by local Anglican minister Clifford Hall, who exhorted the parade rally to not let anyone bully you or torment or terrorize you. They have had their day. Yours is now and tomorrow and forever. So speaking as a priest, I say welcome all to the flock of Christ.
Gay and lesbian couples in Cuba are achingly close to getting the right to marry. The island's National Assembly unanimously approved several changes to the country's constitution on July 23rd that include extending civil marriage rights to same-gender couples. The draft revisions will be open for public consultation and debate from August 13th through November 15th. A referendum in the communist nation will follow. While the revisions also include recognizing private property for the first time in decades, local commentators are calling marriage equality among the most significant. Former Cuban President Raúl Castro's daughter, Mariela Castro Espín, has been the most vocal public advocate for LGBTQ equality on the island and heads the well-respected National Center for Sex Education. She led a conga against homophobia and transphobia in March, where thousands danced down Havana streets among rainbow flags and Fidel Castro banners and led a rally for marriage equality in May. Continuing reverence for Fidel forgives his sending an estimated 25,000 gay men to labor camps in the earlier years of his presidency. He formally apologized for those actions in 2010.
By a vote of 14-11, the Legal Affairs Committee of the Swiss Parliament has recommended marriage equality for lesbian and gay couples, but in carefully modulated stages. Switzerland is one of the few remaining Western European nations to not have opened the civil institution to those couples. They're currently allowed to enter into less than equal registered partnerships. According to a number of national news sites, committee members wanted to separate allowing same-gender couples to marry from related rights to medically assisted procreation, adoption, and spousal pensions equality. They fear that trying to pass a package with all of those rights at one time, the most controversial being access to fertility services, would fail. One lawmaker predicted basic marriage equality for same-gender couples in Switzerland by January 2021. Queer activists generally voiced support for the initiatives, while at the same time lamenting the decision to deal with other rights associated with marriage equality separately and at an as-yet undetermined time.
The intentional exclusion of same-gender couples from reforms to surrogacy laws in Israel sparked massive street demonstrations across the country and a nationwide work stoppage on July 22nd that was supported by many of the country's leading companies. The nation's high court hinted its support for the parental rights of same-gender couples this week in two different cases, though no binding decisions were issued. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has come under specific fire for publicly supporting the inclusion of single men to the law reform that opened surrogacy services to single women, only to vote against including single men 2 days later under pressure from conservative Orthodox members of his coalition government. Until then, only married heterosexual couples could access fertility services in Israel. Many commentators believe that opening surrogacy services to single men as well as to single women would have allowed access to those services by same-gender couples.
Meanwhile, a letter circulating in Israel signed by more than 200 rabbis picked at wounds in the queer community that have yet to heal. It supported earlier comments about surrogacy by Jerusalem's chief rabbi Aryeh Stern, who wrote that allowing same-gender couples to become parents would condemn their children to wretched lives. The letter labeled LGBTQ people perverts who want to destroy the concept of family and called the recent street demonstrations for queer rights marches of abomination. The letter went on to claim that the raising of the Second Temple in Jerusalem almost 2,000 years ago was in part due to illicit sexual relations. Among its many critics, lawmaker Stav Shafir of the center-left Zionist Union Party told LGBTQ young people in particular that you are good people, strong, loving, and most importantly, equal. It is forbidden to spend even a minute on these harsh words of leaders who have lost control and are attempting by force to drag us decades backwards. Israeli society has woken up, she said. Stay strong.
And finally, a Connecticut outlet of the increasingly queer-friendly McDonald's fast food chain has posted a welcome of sorts to its just-opened next-door neighbor, Chick-fil-A. The latter eatery made headlines a few years ago when its unapologetically anti-queer CEO, Dan Cathy, said his business was very supportive of the biblical definition of the family unit. A recent story in The New Yorker reported on the many far-right anti-queer causes Cathy still generously supports and called the restaurant chain's affiliation with conservative religious groups creepy. The sign below the landmark Golden Arches outside the Glastonbury McDonald's usually promotes daily specials. But franchise manager Susan LaFleur put up the simple words, "We welcome everyone," on the side of the marquee facing the next-door chicken franchise. The other side pushes the quarter pounder. LaFleur insisted that the message is not political and that her staff just tries to come up with something cute to say in the limited space on the sign. But photos of the marquee across from the Chick-fil-A have spread like wildfire across social media. New Chick-fil-A franchise owner Jordan Snook was quick to announce that his outlet also welcomes everyone. But McDonald's customer Tina Manis told the local NBC TV affiliate that she drove an hour from her home in Stratford, Connecticut to Glastonbury just to see the shade-throwing signage for herself.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending July 28, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the new and improved thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
I was discriminated against in my country for being a lesbian. They beat me, even some of my friends, when I was 16.
Michael had cried for his mother continuously during the admission process.
Imagine coming from El Salvador to the United States by bus.
Queer persecution amidst the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, later in the program.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
As if being young and transgender were not difficult enough, YouTube may be making it worse. The Outcasting Overtime crew adds up the algorithms.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Dhruv, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. For this edition, Lucas and I considered YouTube's demonetization of videos with transgender content and its algorithms that contribute to fewer views and the potential pairing of anti-LGBTQ ads on these videos.
YouTube has gone from another entertainment platform to a central part of our everyday online lives. If you want to watch videos, you do it on YouTube. If you want to make videos and potentially have them seen by a large audience, you put them on YouTube. If you want to express your ideas in an open forum, you go to YouTube. YouTube is essentially the default for user-made videos, and therefore it has immense power over what we see and how we see it. According to Google, YouTube's parent company, YouTube tags videos based on different keywords in the title and description of the video. The tagging algorithm determines how frequently videos will appear in searches and what ads will run on them. For example, if your video is about growing apples, it may be tagged as agriculture, which doesn't get flagged by YouTube for any kind of negative content. And logically, it could also pair the videos with ads related to agriculture. But YouTube tags videos with certain trigger words that signal that the video is not suitable for advertisers. This includes references to transgender content, and this has caused a recent uproar among LGBTQ YouTube users. This means that videos containing words like these will likely not generate any money, thus demonetizing videos with transgender content. On top of that, YouTubers have flagged YouTube's search algorithm for being biased against transgender videos and producers. YouTube receives less money from the transgender videos, and so it lists these videos lower in search outputs. These videos, therefore, continue to receive fewer views, making them less marketable. This results in fewer transgender YouTubers being willing to produce videos for no money, which, of course, can lead to less transgender content on YouTube. These creators are effectively being silenced, and their ideas are not being discussed in the same open-minded manner as other content on YouTube. Some may argue that as a business corporation, YouTube's main purpose is to turn a profit for its shareholders. But because of its dominance in the marketplace of ideas, it has a responsibility, which it acknowledges in its policy, to provide a platform to free expression. Adding to the problem, some major anti-LGBTQ organizations buy up ads to run on videos with these tags, specifically to dilute the impact of pro-transgender content. A prime example is the so-called Alliance Defending Freedom, or ADF, which has been designated as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. This anti-LGBTQ targeting contradicts YouTube's anti-hate policy, and yet YouTube allows it to continue. A spokesperson for YouTube claimed, "We have policies against ads on YouTube that incite hatred or promote discrimination, and all ads that run on the platform have to comply with these policies. Even when an ad does not violate our policies, we understand that creators may not want ads from certain advertisers appearing on their videos." So aside from making transgender content harder to find and less financially lucrative, YouTube also violates its own anti-hate policy by allowing advertising from anti-LGBTQ groups. YouTube's actions have driven a wedge between transgender content contributors and the roughly 1.8 billion viewers who use YouTube. This has started to mark transgender contributors as different from the hundreds of millions of now normal contributors. It has also set a precedent allowing transgender media and voices to be sidelined and kept as a separate category. YouTube says it has reworked its algorithm, but creators of transgender content continue to be outraged and sidelined. This goes entirely against the official message of YouTube, that it wants everyone to have a voice, and that contributors should be able to choose the ads on their programs. However, the transgender producers have no choice. Either they run anti-transgender ads, or they don't receive any money from their work, and their video ends up at the bottom of people's searches. We know from conversations we've had here at Outcasting that LGBTQ youth often turn to social media to discover a word that gives them an identity and helps connect them to a community. This is particularly true with transgender youth. After years of confusion about their gender identity, they talk about this as a light bulb going off in their head. "Hey, that's what I am, transgender. It's amazing to finally have a word. There must be other people like me." It's a very powerful and life-changing moment. But if YouTube suppresses this content, it can deprive young people of this critical knowledge. And the situation is exacerbated by the presence on these videos of pre-roll ads from ADF and other anti-LGBTQ groups. Imagine that you're a vulnerable, troubled young teenager who has always felt different but has never known exactly why. You find something on social media, you have that light bulb moment, and everything finally comes into focus, but you're still tentative and maybe a bit fragile. Then you go to YouTube and search for videos that talk about being transgender. Under YouTube's tagging policies, finding that video is harder, and when you do find it, expecting to see something good, something that affirms what little you know about being trans, you're actually bombarded with an anti-LGBTQ ad before you even get to the content you want. Maybe the ad terrifies you, and you turn it off before you even get to the video you wanted to watch. Is it really that hard to figure out that that's exactly what ADF wants? Depriving youth of information that can help them can lead to horrible outcomes. And it's unconscionable for YouTube to suppress this content when it can help so many young people at a vulnerable and fragile point in their lives. YouTube's hypocritical stance is shutting out the voices that need to be heard, and this needs to stop.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
You can tweet your concerns about YouTube's policies to @TeamYouTube.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out.
The day we reunited, it was like he felt hurt that I had left him, like he had something that he wanted to tell me, but at his age, he just couldn't express it.
A lesbian mom's asylum nightmare. But first, the grand old rainbow flag turned 40 this year, and a Rainbow Minute looks back at its record-breaking silver anniversary.
A rainbow from sea to sea, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. In 2003, Gilbert Baker, the creator of the original rainbow flag back in 1978, was commissioned to produce a giant rainbow flag for the 25th anniversary of the flag itself. With hot pink no longer a non-standard color for flag production, the flag was restored to its original 8 colors for its silver anniversary unfurling. Those colors included hot pink, red, orange, yellow, green, turquoise, indigo, and violet. Dubbed Rainbow 25 Sea to Sea, the mile and a quarter long by 16 foot wide flag was displayed in Key West, Florida on June 15, 2003. Over 3,000 volunteers held the flag, which ran the length of Duval Street from the Atlantic Ocean on one end to the Gulf of Mexico on the other. At the time, it was deemed the world's longest flag. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Richmond City Councilman Charles Samuels.
Gilbert Baker died in his sleep at his home in New York City on March 31, 2017, at the age of 65.
Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
Mother, mother, keep me safe.
Toddlers are being torn from their parents and thrown into U.S. immigration baby jails, and the circumstances driving those parents to seek asylum are being ignored. This White House Lucia Chappelle has the story of one mother trying to escape violent homophobia at home.
Belky Yesenia Castillo-Cortez arrived at the legal port of entry in Rio Grande City with her 3-year-old son Michael on May 28th. Cortez is a lesbian from El Salvador seeking asylum in the U.S. She explained why in an interview on Democracy Now!
Because I'm in danger in my country. I'm in danger because of the gangs, because of the discrimination, the threats. The same person who raped me in January 2014 is the person who left me pregnant with my child. I was discriminated against in my country for being a lesbian. They beat me, even some of my friends, when I was 16. And the father, if I can call him that, he raped me for the same reason, for being a lesbian, and with the aim of making me pregnant.
Cortez and her son escaped the persecution they faced at home, only to be caught up in the chaos at the U.S. border. They were detained and separated under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy. Cortez was kept at a detention center in Texas, while Michael was flown to a holding facility run by a human services agency in New York City. It took nearly a month and a half for them to be reunited, and their nightmare was still not over.
Suddenly they called me, and oh, it was so beautiful because it had been 41 days without my son, and I felt like I couldn't any longer. The reunion with my son was something, well, it was emotional, but also sad because he didn't react the way his mother, the way I imagined he would have reacted. He just turned and looked at me. He didn't cry. He just looked into my eyes. He looked at me and never broke his gaze.
As the extended Democracy Now! Interview continued, Michael started biting a Nerf ball. And by the time it was over, he had chewed the ball completely into pieces. Michael's discharge papers from the holding facility described him as laid back, quiet, and kindly, but also noted his difficulty adapting to the program, as Michael had cried for his mother continuously during the admission process. Cortez talked about the traumatic impact of the separation and detention on her son.
His behavior is really aggressive. He doesn't listen to me at all. Yes, I'm having this problem because since we arrived, he's been acting this way, and he wasn't like this before. I went with him in buses the whole way, and imagine coming from El Salvador to the United States by bus. I brought him from there to here, and everything was fine, because in truth, he wasn't like this before. Because to travel 6 hours, 8 hours on a bus with a child, as he's acting now, I imagine I would have had to return to my country. But no, he held out till the 28th of May, and now he's acting very differently. He doesn't listen. He's violent, more than anything else with me. Ever since he was released to me, he doesn't listen to me anymore. Sometimes he hits me. The day we reunited, the reunion, it was like he felt hurt that I had left him. Something like that. I felt like he had something that he wanted to tell me, but at his age, he just couldn't express it because he just stayed looking at me with a face, with a gaze that told me everything. It was beautiful to reunite with him, but to be confronted with this, no. A week has passed, exactly. At the beginning, it was the same. He didn't seem to love me very much, but now, thank God, it's changing a bit. Now he knows our family. Now he's remembered because, well, maybe it's more like he never forgot. It was just the feelings that he had because he felt abandoned.
Belka Yesenia Castillo-Cortez and her son Michael are out of detention and awaiting a decision on their asylum request. Cortez is being tracked by the government with an ankle monitor while her case is pending, and Michael is receiving psychological services provided by immigrant rights organizations. The lesbian mother holds on to the hope of finding liberation in the U.S.
I want a future. I want to begin a future with a person I love to marry. I also want that. I want to be happy with my child and my family. I also want protection and the support I don't have in my country. This is why I came, for a happy future. Because up until now, it hasn't. I've never had any freedom, not even with the girlfriends I've had. Absolutely nothing. It's as if we're not there. We've always been hidden. It hasn't been freedom or happiness. Not at all.
For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Our thanks again to Democracy Now! And reporter Laura Gottesdiener. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Michelle Yater, produced with Ryan DeShazer, from Outcasters Drew and Lucas, produced by Mark Soffice, Charles Samuels, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Lucia Chappell, with thanks to Democracy Now!. David Brown and Chris Williamson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the redesigned thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WNJR, Washington, Pennsylvania, to TLC, Yamba, New South Wales, WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What can one commodity crop tell us about capitalist domination? Well, if it's the banana, then quite a lot. Especially as seen through the lens of French documentary maker Mathilde Demoiselle, director of When Banana Ruled. The film explores the ways that the banana industry, often synonymous with the United Fruit Company, spread capitalism to Central America, toppled governments that didn't do its bidding, while at the same time creating a market for banana consumption in the United States, manipulating the public for private gain with the help of Sigmund Freud's notorious nephew, Edward Bernays, the father of the public relations industry. The film is remarkably complex, exploring the environmental devastation caused by the banana industry, the racial segregation and political control of its labor force, and the role of the CIA in Central America. Today is the final day that Against the Grain will come to you during KPFA's summer fund drive, and we're hoping that with your help, we can go out with a bang, offering to you this superlative film as a thank you gift for your pledge of support to the station. Here's an edited excerpt from the film, When Banana Ruled.
I get the blues in the morning, I get the blues in the night, but when I eat a banana sundae,
this is the story of a fruit which altered the destiny of Central America and gave its name to republics.
It became notorious. It became the symbol of all that's wrong with American capitalism.
This is an economic and political tale, a little story about globalization. This is the story of a fruit, a simple fruit, the banana. It all began in 1871, when the government in Costa Rica asked a certain miner Cooper Keith from New York to construct a railway. It was to link the Caribbean coast to the high plateaus through the jungle. But nothing went as planned. The jungle was pitiless. Accidents, scorpions, malaria. 4,000 men died for just 40 kilometers of railway. And when a stock market crash dragged the world economy into a depression, credit disappeared. Costa Rica could no longer pay. The railway remained unfinished. Mina was ruined. He did not yet know that fortune was in fact right there, at his feet, in the humid soil of the jungle. In these unpretentious rhizomes which he had planted to feed his workers, in this fruit, the simple fruit of the tropics, the banana. The simple food of Costa Rican workers, the banana appeared at the turn of the century in northern markets in the United States. It was a prized delicacy, expensive because it was rare and perishable. Whoever managed to transport it quickly enough before it could ripen and rot could turn it into gold. And Miner recognized that. Very soon, he was exporting bananas. They saved him from ruin. He struck an agreement with Costa Rica. He would finish work on the railway. In return, he asked for just two things: the right to operate the line for his own profit and land. Lots of it. Land for producing bananas. Trains for transporting them quickly and cheaply. This was the start of his fortune. In 1899, Miner joined forces with two Boston wholesalers. He put in his plantations and his Central American railways. His associates provided a fleet of ships and a distribution network across the United States. On the 30th of March, 1899, together, they founded the United Fruit Company.
My working definition of a multinational is a company which owns and controls assets in more than one country. I would say it's among the first of the multinationals in this kind of like primary commodity type of business. And it's really taking the process of vertical integration to quite an extreme extent, including, you know, constructing what's going to become one of the biggest shipping fleets in the world, and integrating right down through to distribution in the United States. So it's really quite extreme at this time. But they're pioneering in a more fundamental way, because this company is actually creating a market for bananas, as well as pioneering how to deliver the product to that consumer. So in 1890, nobody in the United States really knew what a banana was, basically. By 1914, you can buy bananas in virtually all big American towns.
Delicious, nourishing, full of vitamins. The United Fruit Company had a flair for promoting bananas. Mothers of families were the target. They published recipes, solicited pediatricians who sang their praises. Very soon, Americans could no longer do without them. Imported by the ton, reasonably priced, they were accessible to everyone.
We have no bananas. We have no
bananas were fragile. Tempests, flooding, and heat waves regularly devastated the plantations. Bananas could become scarce.
But yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas.
For Miner and his associates, it was obvious. They needed to produce more, ever more bananas over a much larger area, right across Central America. Banana Land. This was the Central American nations. Former Spanish colonies, they had won their independence at the beginning of the 19th century. But the United States regarded them as its private hunting ground, a natural extension of their market. For the United Fruit Company, this was one single territory, completely given over to the production of bananas. The United Fruit Company kept on growing. It needed ever more land. In Panama and Costa Rica, Indian farmers who had no property rights were evicted. By cutting the price of bananas, it threatened to ruin any small producers who refused to give up their banana plantations. Little by little, it took over hundreds of thousands of hectares of Central America's best land.
It's exactly what happened during the land reforms in Great Britain, which began in the 16th century and carried on until the 18th century. You had poor British land workers who were expropriated in the same way. There's no other word for it. The land which they cultivated started to have fences put up around it. And by the 18th century, they had been obliged to give up their workforce to the factories which were beginning to appear. So in reality, this movement is at the origin of contemporary industry and economy as we know them today. It was the founding act of contemporary capitalism.
Did the United Fruit Company introduce capitalism to Central America?
And that question is one of the many posed and explored in a really remarkably complex and well-presented and accessible documentary, When Banana Ruled. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. And KPFA's in the waning days of our summer fun drive. And this is the final hour that Against the Grain will come to you. The final day Against the Grain will come to you during this fun drive asking for your support. So we're hoping to be able to make a respectable amount of money on our way out here with your help and hopefully give you many good reasons to support this institution, KPFA. This documentary is really terrific, and I should say it is on DVD. $150 or more pledge will get you the DVD When Banana Ruled by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or going to kpfa.org, which is probably the most cost-effective way that you can donate to us, and we can receive your donation, although we'd like to encourage you to do it whatever way works for you. $150 pledge or more gets you this really fantastic documentary that explores, uses the banana, the ubiquitous banana, to explore how multinational corporations rule and really to look at capitalism, how it both transforms the environment, controls labor, and shapes our desires as consumers, and distorts the public, manipulates the public for private gain. So on every stage within this process. A few companies have been more emblematic as multinational companies than the United Fruit Company. And so the film traces its history and its enormous power with the backing of the U.S. state. There's a lot more of this film I'd like to play, but I do want to encourage a whole number of you to go to your phones right now and support us. We are a bit short in this drive, and we have quite a bit of ground to make before we end the drive on Friday. So we're really, really turning to our listeners and asking for as much support as you can muster right now. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And I should let you know that we are offering, as well as the DVD, One Banana Ruled, for a $150 pledge of support. You can also get it as part of a film pack, a three-film pack, that we are very pleased to offer. It's When Banana Ruled, Digital Disconnect, which you may have heard us highlighting some excerpts from last week, Robert McChesney, the media critic, talking about how the internet went from a public creation to a massive engine of private wealth, a similar theme, actually, and there's some interesting crossovers between thinking about the banana industry and thinking about tech. So it's Digital Disconnect. And then we're also including the film No Gods, No Masters, which is a three-part history of anarchism. So you can get, for your $400 pledge, When Banana Ruled, Digital Disconnect, and No Gods, No Masters by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go to kpfa.org. And I'm hoping that a number of our listeners, perhaps you listening right this moment, will think about pledging at the $400 rate, because you will know that you're sustaining this remarkable institution that allows the space to look very critically at the history of capitalism, like this documentary film does, When Banana Ruled. Let's go back to more of it, but please call and pledge while the film is running, and we can see right here for everyone who does call and pledge, and we are so grateful to you. 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org, and now more When Banana Ruled.
1944, revolution came to Guatemala. It put an end to the 14-year reign of the dictator. Despite the company controlling every moment of its employees' lives, demands started to be made. For a 6-day week and an 8-hour day, unemployment benefit and salaries paid in cash. Throughout Banana Land, anger was growing. The company became alarmed. Circular number B21. From the United Fruit Company General Offices to Banana Division Managers. I am joining a photograph for the purpose of familiarizing you with the appearance of Manuel Calix Herrera. This man is an agitator of the worst type. Anti-American, extremist, given to writing and preaching red, Bolshevist, and communistic propaganda. Be on the lookout. In October 1928, workers at the Santa Marta plantation in Colombia went on strike. Negotiations failed. Strikers attacked buildings on the plantation. The Colombian government sent in the army. Over 1,000 died. The suppression of the Santa Marta strike became known as the Banana Massacre, a fundamental point in history for Colombia and Central America. The symbol of state submission, with use of its public forces to support the interests of a foreign company. From then on, throughout the Caribbean, everybody spoke of the Octopus, the new name for the United Fruit Company. In June 1929, Minor Cooper Keith, the banana pioneer, the uncrowned king of Central America, died in Costa Rica. The empire he left behind was immense. 100,000 employees, 1,200,000 hectares of plantations. In 1910, buying up the British wholesaler Fife's had opened the doors of Europe to him. At the time of Minor's death, the United Fruit Company alone represented 3/4 of the world's banana trade. A few competitors survived in the shadows. The United Fruit Company tolerated them. They allowed it to avoid the American antitrust laws, which forbade monopolies. The Cuyamel Fruit Company was the company's principal competitor. At its head was Samuel Zamari. He was tall and gruff, with a strong Russian accent. He was seen as a visionary, capable of making bananas grow on the most hostile land. In 1910, he had overturned the government of Honduras, which had tried to get in his way, and he didn't hide the fact. In Banana Land, this man was a legend. Samuel Zimari stood up to United Fruit for a long time, until his competition became too troublesome for them. In November 1929, he accepted a merger. United Fruit bought out his company, Cuyamel. Samuel received $30 million worth of United Fruit Company shares. This made him one of the richest men in the United States, and also United Fruit's biggest shareholder. Samuel Zimari was the uncontested czar of bananas. An empire cannot stand still. If it doesn't grow, it falls. The Second World War froze international trade, but with the end of the war came the promise of reconstruction, of growth, of new markets for United Fruit's bananas. To conquer them, Samuel Zimari found the right person, a pioneer of his own kind, the Prince of Public Relations and Publicity, Edward Bernays. He was a man with the gift of being able to fashion reality according to his clients' wishes. In the 1920s, it was this man, Edward Bernays, who had got American women smoking, convincing them that the cigarette was a torch of liberty, the instrument of their emancipation. This was during his time working for the powerful American Tobacco Company. In his book entitled Propaganda, Edward Bernays defended, in his own words, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses by an enlightened minority. Could it have been his uncle, Sigmund Freud, who led him to understand so early on that in a consumer society, publicity was the key to desire, and that consumer desire could be created, maintained, and stimulated ad infinitum?
Bananas are a favorite breakfast fruit in every home. Sliced over hot or cold cereal, they top off any dish and help start the day right.
Samuel Zimari was to turn the banana into the fruit of American dreams.
We know you like bananas.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way. And when they're flecked with brown and have a golden hue, bananas taste the best and are the best for you.
Miss Chiquita Banana burst onto the radio waves and television screens. She was everywhere.
The way you're looking means that you are ripe for cooking. I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say that they really use refrigerators up this way. I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say that you really shouldn't treat a fellow man this way. If you like to be refined and civilized, your eating habits really ought to be revised.
Her tone of voice and curvaceous form were similar to those of a star of the time, Carmen Miranda, the Brazilian in the Tutti Frutti hat who featured in Hollywood comedies. This was not by chance. Carmen Miranda was South America as the United States wished to portray it. Exotic, eccentric, but close by. A continuation of itself.
The lady in the tutti frutti hat.
In the ideal world of Miss Chiquita Banana, each banana was calibrated both by form and by taste. The company only produced one variety, the Gros Michel. Tasty, fleshy, resistant, and therefore exportable. Ever more needed to be produced.
But it is not enough to have the right conditions for the bananas to flourish.
It is also necessary to fight constantly the diseases that can ruin whole plantations.
On the plantations, weakened by intensive monoculture, two virulent parasites were spreading: Panama disease and yellow sigatoka. Miss Chiquita Banana's swaying hips couldn't hide the reality. The empire was rotting from the inside. Samuel Zimari had tons of pesticide poured over the banana plants, relentlessly, up to 30 times a year. Those who volunteered received the best pay. They were known as the veneneros, the poisoners. Very soon, their skin took on a blue tint. They fell ill. Dozens died.
See how each bunch is dipped several times. Great care is taken to see that the bunches are clean before they leave the plantation.
From 10 years, the lifetime of a plantation fell to 3. The infected ones were abandoned. The jungle was cut down to create new ones. Always more. As though Central America could be totally given over to United Fruit.
And an excerpt from the film, When Banana Ruled. I'm Sasha Lilly, it's Against the Grain, and we are offering this thank you gift to you for $150 or more. Pledge to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or going to kpfa.org. This documentary is a really fantastic look at the history of the banana industry, and particularly the United Fruit Company. But it's not a narrow history. It's actually a history that is about capitalism itself. And it's about how the history of the banana and of United Fruit really illuminate the ways capitalism works and has great resonance today in thinking about all the processes put in motion. It's wonderfully produced. It draws on a rich trove of archival footage. Documents are included in here, including letters from lobbyists, telegrams that really illustrate the power of the United Fruit over the fates of the countries in Central America and the degree to which the American state massively backed the banana industry, U.S. multinational corporations, and their control over these countries, which were literally subjected to the power of a private company located elsewhere. So it's a history of, in many ways, the relationships of power in the Western Hemisphere, about the emergence, the growth of capitalism in Central America, the fascinating parallels in that, as one of the experts who's interviewed in the film says, similar process that took place in England with the formation of capitalism there took place in Central America, where you had a situation where later historically in time, that the banana industry went and enclosed the land of those peasants who lived off the land in Central America and forced them into a situation of being the wage labor on these plantations. And the plantations basically took over these countries, enormous swaths of land completely dominated by banana production. And as you heard in the last clip, it was one variety of banana, a monoculture. So when there were parasites that came along that it couldn't, was not resistant to, there was both massive pesticide use, but also the rapid turnover of land that was then abandoned and new plantations were formed, were established elsewhere, and jungles cut down. So enormous devastation on a human and ecological level, and really illustrates some of the fundamental processes of capitalism and an empire, informal empire. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call if you'd like to pick up this DVD, When Banana Ruled, for $150 or more contribution to KPFA. And please think about becoming a sustainer, and give what you can, and give it on a monthly basis. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We also want to encourage you to give at kpfa.org because it's the most cost-effective way for us to receive your donation. We also are offering up to you this film as part of a 3-DVD film pack. So you can get, for a $400 pledge, When Banana Ruled, Digital Disconnect, which features media critic Robert McChesney talking about how the internet went from being a public good to something that has been privately owned, and it has become the generation of all sorts of wealth inequality. And also the film about the history of anarchism, a film in three parts, No Gods, No Masters. So if you're able to give at the level of $400 or more, we have some excellent thank you gifts on offer. Obviously, what you're really funding, the thing that is most important here, is this institution itself, which has been critical since its inception and not beholden to the kind of private commercial interests that are the focus of this film, When Banana Ruled. The film highlights the manipulation of the public by private interests, by the PR industry. KPFA has been about educating the public, allowing the public to have information that would otherwise be closed off and is not shaped by these private commercial interests or corporations like a United Fruit or its contemporaries. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Today is the last day that Against the Grain will come to you during this fund drive. And I should say that we really have a lot of ground to make up as a station, and including this program is included in that. And KPFA really operates on a shoestring. What we do here is when we get your donations, we stretch as far as we possibly can. But there are some fundamental costs that we have, and we need your support. For us to fall short on our financial goal, there's really no fat in there. There's no extra cushion. If we fall short in this fund drive, it really will have an impact on what we're able to do in this radio station. So I really hope you will feel moved to give at whatever level you can. And if you don't want to thank you gift, you know, really, although I'm so, I really enjoyed presenting this documentary film to you today, it's not about the thank you gifts ultimately. We're so happy, we're totally happy to send it to you. If you'd like a thank you gift, you can choose from the ones we have on offer in this hour or anything we've offered during this drive. But really, it's about sustaining KPFA and keeping it going. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. Let's now go back to more from When Banana Ruled.
In 1944, revolution came to Guatemala. It put an end to the 14-year reign of the dictator Ubico, the best friend of the United Fruit Company. Ubico saw himself as the reincarnation of Napoleon and was so protective of his power that he banned the use of the words strike, petition, and union. He believed in forced labor for the poorest and in the lowest possible salaries. The agreements which he signed with United Fruit were highly favorable for them.
Multinationals like United Fruit sought stability for its investments. Democracies can be very unstable. I mean, there's a reason why multinational investment is very low in India, and the reason is it's a democracy where there are multiple parties always sort of checking deals, negotiating everything, and that's a veritable
nightmare for multinationals, and they prefer to operate in China, for example, where provided the Communist Party approves of your activities, you'll have a high degree of stability and things will basically, you won't run into any sort of trouble. So I think that's what multinationals are after, some sort of security and stability. And tin pot dictators or the Communist Party can give you that.
With its promise of labor laws, union rights, and minimum wage, the Guatemalan Revolution certainly offered no reassurance concerning the company's business affairs. In 1951, free elections brought Colonel Jacobo Arbenz to power. Despite his Germanic origins, he had grown up in the poverty of a high plains village. He was a white man brought up amongst Guatemala's underprivileged, Indians of Maya origin. Jacobo Arbenz set about putting into practice the first promise of the revolution, land reform, which would redistribute the land of the large owners to the small farmers. But at the top of the list of large owners, with more than two-thirds of the country's agricultural land, was the United Fruit Company.
Almost two-thirds of its population is of Indian descent, living primitively, barely getting sustenance from the soil. In a nation of many large, efficiently run plantations geared to produce maximum profit,
Arbenz dared to take them on. By decree, he confiscated hundreds of thousands of hectares of land which the company kept in reserve. The indemnities were derisory. They were based on the company's tax declarations, which had always underestimated the value. United Fruit had never before been defied in this way. In his youth, Samuel Zimari had had no qualms about overturning a troublesome government. This time, with no mercenaries at hand, he once again turned to the public relations genius, Edward Bernays. It was up to him to deal with Arbenz. Bernays was to employ a technique of which he was the master, transforming reality. He set about turning the protection of United Fruit's private interests in Guatemala into a cause for the United States, making the banana a strategic pawn. Edward Bernays was to create a fiction for 1950s America, submerged in the Cold War.
Guatemalan town of Equipulas, just occupied by anti-government forces.
Social democrat, nationalist, reformer, Jacobo Arbenz was depicted as a communist pledged to Moscow, the face of the red peril which threatened America versus the free world. Edward Bernays needed to win over public opinion. He opened a Central American Information Bureau, organized press visits, and suggested themes for articles to newspaper owners who he was close to.
So Bernays really understood it's not what is happening, it's the story you tell about what is happening that is the reality. And that's something he was greatly admired and studied in Nazi Germany, who carried post-truth to another level. And now we see in our present world with social networks and much else, this story intensifying with all its severe consequences for democracy. But we could already see where it was going to lead with episodes like Bernays and United Fruit.
The context was ripe for Edward Bernays' power play. In November 1952, the Republican Dwight Eisenhower was elected President of the United States.
God, so help me God.
After years of policies designed to contain communism, he advocated a frontal offensive. He placed two brothers in key posts. John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State. Alan Dulles was put in charge of the CIA. Both of them had been close legal advisors to the United Fruit Company. As for the new ambassador to the United Nations, this was none other than the flamboyant Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, a faithful lobbyist for the company's interests, whose family were long-standing shareholders. These were all people tuned in to Edward Bernays' message.
Mr. Dulles, I know you've heard this many times, that there are people who say that we, with regard to the CIA, are waging a secret war with an invisible government.
We are obviously engaged in many facets of what is generally called the Cold War, which the communist policy has forced upon us. But may I say this, and I do it with all solemnity, at no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity or any intelligence activity that was not approved at the highest level.
In August 1953, Alan Dulles' CIA began a new means of attack. In Iran, it overturned the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized his country's petrol industry. He was accused of communist collusion. Petrol before bananas? The success of the Iranian operation convinced the Eisenhower administration. The CIA was given the green light to take action in Guatemala. The operation was named Success. The patient lobbying by Edward Bernays had borne fruit. The CIA chose an opponent for the Arbenz regime. Colonel Castillo Armas. It placed him at the head of a National Liberation Army which it was training. The plantations of the United Fruit Company were used as rearguard bases. In June 1954, the capital, Guatemala City, was bombed. Overpowered, Jacobo Arbenz stood down on the 27th of June in a radio announcement. Having become president with support from the United States, Castillo Armas cancelled the measures taken by the Arbenz government. Land reform was abandoned. United Fruit had its lands given back. But neither stability nor security returned. Following the coup d'etat, Guatemala was thrown into civil war, which continued until 1996, leaving more than 100,000 dead, a million displaced, and tens of thousands missing. The Maya Indians were the principal victims, with talk of genocide.
An excerpt from the film When Banana Rolled. I'm Sasha Lilly, alongside C.S. Song, and we are here during the last day that Against the Grain will come to you during this summer fun drive to raise money for this radio station and for this program and to allow a place to continue that brings you critical perspectives like those that you're used to on this program and like those of this fantastic film, When Banana Ruled. The film, which you can get for $150 or more, pledged to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732 or going to kpfa.org, talks about the history of the United Fruit Company in Central America and its pioneering role as a multinational corporation. And in showing that history, it tells us actually a great deal about the companies of our time, which have learned from that history and built from that history, and about the about capitalism itself and its relationship to informal empire. The film looks at the way that the U.S. state has backed the United Fruit Company, backed it in its history, against the democratically elected governments of the region, including that of Arbenz in the 1950s, which it overthrew, the United States overthrew at the behest of the United Fruit Company after a similar government, or at least a government that had been doing something similar in Iran. The government of Mossadegh, which had nationalized the petroleum industry, was overthrown. That was seen to be successful. So then Arbenz, who was a social democrat, was overthrown in Guatemala for having expropriated some of the land of the United Fruit Company. And those who were behind those actions were themselves tied to the United Fruit Company. John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, and his brother Alan Dulles, head of the CIA. So it's a story about the way that capitalism and empire have operated in the Western Hemisphere. And but it does so through the tale of the banana. So it's actually a combination of a very complex theme told very, very simply. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and kpfa.org. And you can also get, if you are thinking about pledging at a higher rate, because you may have heard that KPFA is in danger of coming up very short during the summer fun drive, you can get When Banana Ruled along with two other films in our film combo pack, four DVDs for $400, three DVDs for $400, When Banana Ruled, Digital Disconnect, featuring Robert McChesney, the media critic, talking about how private commercial interests took over the public promise of the internet, which was created with public resources, and the history of anarchism in three parts, No Gods, No Masters. For $400 or more, you can get those. But I'd like to just encourage you to give whatever you can, small or large, right now, on this final day for Against the Grain, not for the rest of the station, of our summer fund drive. The station's the fund drive ends for everyone on Friday, and we have a lot of ground to make up between then and now. We have done so in the past. I think we can do so again with your help. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. And I want to thank some very generous listeners who have pledged so far. James Webb in San Jose, thank you so, so much for your pledge. Rosemary Kuhn in Fresno, we want to thank you so much. Mujahideen Sumchai in Richmond, thank you so much for your pledge of support. We really appreciate your generosity. And Wiles, we so appreciate to hear from you. Thank you so much for your pledge of support. Won't you join them right now by calling 1-800-439-5732 or going to kpfa.org. And CS, I'm just sort of losing track of the time here and how much time we have. We've been handed a $800 match by four listeners, Sandra in Petaluma, Jan in San Jose, and Walter in Corona, and Christine in Vacaville. Sandra, Jan, Walter, and Christine together are putting up $800. If we can raise the equivalent amount from now to the top of the hour. And actually, the top of the hour is not too far off. We've got 7 minutes, just over 7 minutes, to be able to make it. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
Yeah, last 7.5 minutes, this fund drive that you can specifically vote for KPFA, register your support for, specifically against the grain is what I meant. 1-800-439-5732. This film, When Banana Ruled, has been a blockbuster in terms of people calling and wanting to get it, join in and get educated. You know, there's so much in here. I find it very interesting when books and films focus on a single commodity and then just kind of tell the history of so much through that commodity. And of course, the presence of Edward Bernays, the father, the so-called father of public relations, is a fascinating part of this film. When Banana Ruled, $150 or more pledge to KPFA. And again, for $400, you can get the combo of really three of the films that this fund drive have attracted a large part of the attention. They've been very popular with listeners because they're so educational and so interesting and so beautifully produced. When Banana Ruled, and as Sasha was saying, Digital Disconnect, about how capitalism is turning the internet against democracy, and No Gods, No Masters, a history of anarchist thought and practice. Now, you can ask for any thank you gift by calling 1-800-439-5732. You are not confined to just asking for what we are offering this hour. You might not want to ask for any thank you gift, knowing that when you do that, we'll actually get more of the benefit of your donation, because then we don't have to purchase stuff, books or DVDs, and then package them and send them out to you. So if you want to, and a lot of people do give without asking for a thank you gift, but of course you are more than welcome to ask for the DVD of When Banana Ruled or the combo pack of the three films for a $400 pledge, all of which are doubled. So critical time to call, 5.5 minutes left. Yeah, I mean, against the grain, the numbers haven't been great this fund drive. Let me just put it that way. So we like to carry our weight around the station. We like to show management that our listeners really do care about what we are doing and value what we are doing. So if you want to specifically note your support, register your support for this program, what Sasha does and what I do 3 days a week. It's not easy. No one's living high on the hog here. 1-800-439-5732. It's an easy call. It's a quick call. You'll feel great. We'll feel great. We'll go out with a bang, and that's that would make us feel a lot better as we move forward.
1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. If you can give it the $150 or more rate, pick up When Banana Ruled. If you'd like to pledge at the $400 rate, we're happy to send you When Banana Ruled along with Digital Disconnect and No Gods, No Masters. Or choose an amount you want to give and give accordingly. $800 is on the line by these four generous listeners, Sandra, Jan, Walter, and Christine. And we're really grateful to them. We're also grateful to have a phenomenal community of listeners out there who have come forward for us time and again. And we know we can do it again with your support. We hope you'll do it right now. This thank you gift would be a wonderful gift to give to someone who might be sort of trying to come to grips with the world that we live in, because it sort of tells us how we got here. And it also informs of us of our place in the world, because, of course, United Fruit and isn't just any multinational corporation. It's one that its history is very much connected to that of the U.S. state. And that U.S. state has been a fundamental driver in capitalism worldwide, a fundamental supporter of the actions of multinational corporations around the world. And, you know, just take the history of Guatemala. I mean, it's so it's something that I think many people in the United States have no idea about and probably would be quite outraged if they did. But this U.S. back coup of the against the Arbenz government in the mid-50s then led to dictatorship and civil war that lasted until the mid-1990s. And over 100,000 people were killed. And the United States is absolutely culpable in that. So this is part of history we need to know as people living in the United States, because, of course, your tax dollars actually do subsidize actions of the state and also actually subsidize multinational corporations. So if you find that outrageous and would like to support an institution that really has pushed back against that, pushed back against capitalism, against corporate rule, and against U.S. empire, then please consider pledging and supporting us in the next 2 minutes before our hour is up and we have to get off the air. $800 is on the line. So what it really means is when you give right now, you're giving more than you yourself might be able to afford, because these four listeners will double your donation dollar for dollar, but you have to do it before the hour is up. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. So many wonderful thank you gifts on offer. If you'd like to get the film pack, When Banana Ruled, Digital Disconnect, and No Gods, No Masters, $400 would certainly take us a good ways toward making this $800 match. If that's just too steep for you, think about giving at the $150 level or even the $50 level. Whatever you can afford, we really are totally grateful, because KPFA is this unusual institution that really is so rare in this country, an institution that is not dependent on commercial interests, given how much that has been privatized, even things like public media being, in fact, partially privatized. We do it because of you, because we're not connected to the United Fruit companies of the day, to the tech companies of today. We do this independently because you keep us independent, but it only works if you're there for us. 1-800-439-5732. CS, we've got 45 seconds to go. $800 is on the line. We have no idea if we've made that match.
That means it's still out there and your dollars are still doubled. 1-800-439-5732. Give us a call. Give us a call now. Pick up the phone. If you like what we do, if we give something to you every time you listen to Against the Grain, say thank you by giving us a call and supporting us right now. 1-800-439-5732. You can make that call, and when you make that call, then we are allowed to be supported and sustained by people like you, and that is so important. It's the only way we can do what we do. 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.